scale civil disobedience and acts of nonviolence against Israel's military occupation to demonstrate that it's wrong on a moral level. Now, what happens when you have international, Israeli, and Palestinian...
The American dream. Free speech isn't free if you don't use it. So call Bob now at 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Now, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Alrighty then, Tuesday, not Monday, right? Yeah. So it's going to be one of those weird short weeks. But it was a short week last week, and I've been gone since Wednesday, and I've been sort of howling to get back to the back behind the microphone just because of everything that's been going on. I'm tempted at the outset of this program to deliver a patented, trademarked, otherwise guaranteed, blistering assault on what passes for my political party. I won't. Everybody else already's done it. There's no need for me to cover this ground again. You're disgusted. I'm disgusted. We're disgusted. Anybody with a conscience is disgusted with what the Democrats did in their rollover, bend the ankles capitulation for George Bush last week. And frankly, I don't care how hard they try. I'm not buying the spin that, well, you know, it was the others who did it. It was just a handful of Democrats, and it was all the Republicans, and we just couldn't stop them. Bug spray. You know, I was born at night, not last night. And Mama didn't raise no dummy. I know when I've been brought to the wrestling match. Oh, look, it was the people in the red trunks and the red masks who got to win. Next week, the people in the blue masks and the blue trunks would get to win. Yay! Oh, I like the people in the blue. Oh, you like the people in the red? Oh, you're not my friend. Bug spray. We've been conned, sunshine. We've been conned. Now, is this a moment to reflect once again upon the three great rules of life? Screw the Ten Commandments. Throw them out the window. You can get through life on the three laws of human nature that were enunciated by the late, great W.C. Fields. And the first one is, you can't cheat an honest man. Now, take a look at the capitulation vote and count the honest people. Because there was a whole bunch of cheating going on. Nancy Pelosi did a bunch of it. Harry Reid, who came out and called the legislation weak tea. Well, apparently somebody must have given him a phone call that made him soil his sacred underwear. Because George Bush has enough money to go on killing Americans and go on killing Iraqis for another few months.
Oh, but in September there's going to be the report from David Petraeus, and then we'll know what to do. Let's go see the wizard. The wizard will know how to get us back to Kansas.
Bug spray. Just a bunch of damn poison. Oh, look, I'm doing it anyway. Those moments make you sick, though, don't they? They fill you with outrage and disgust. The Democratic Party had a chance to do what it was put in office to do, and it chose not to do that. It chose the path of what it perceived to be the least resistance. Well, screw the anti-war people. Screw the progressives. Screw the liberals. By God, in 2 years, there will be a choice between one of us and a Republican. And those progressives and those liberals and those anti-war people, they'll know where to vote. They're damn sure not going to vote for some crazy-ass Republican, are they? They'll vote for us just like they always do. Because after all, even if we're not that good, we are damn sure better than the Republicans. Newsflash. And I used to, oh Lord, I don't know, maybe it's time for me to eat some crow. Because I used to get, and I do mean all over, the Naderites. Who went along with Ralph Nader in the year 2000. When he said, there's no difference between Al Gore and George Bush. It's just same guy, same suit. And it still makes me mad when I think about that, because there was enough of a difference to have saved, oh, 700,000 lives. There was enough of a difference to keep 9/11 from happening. There was enough of a difference to keep our surplus in place instead of squandering it on the Lark's Vomit canape crowd. And yet you get what happened late last week and you look up and go, here's the new boss, same as the old boss. And you know that you're right when you say it. No, this was a chess game. This was a chess match. This is a part of a grand strategy. What did they call it in the great book, Forrest Gump? Oh, yeah, this is the cooking pot variation on the grass hut ploy. And we don't understand because we don't see the strategical moves that the Democrats in Congress are making, because they're really going to paint George Bush into a corner next time, unless, of course, he calls them a bunch of liberal sissies, in which case they'll wet their pants and run into a corner and shake, just like they did this time. I don't know. If you want to talk about it tonight, we will. There's outrage left for enough for a year of shows. The betrayal that was handed to the United States of America. The betrayal that was handed to the United States military for those people The Democratic Party betrayed the military, not when they refused to send George Bush the perfect bill that he yearned for. No, no, the betrayal happened this last week. How many American soldiers did we lose over the Memorial Day weekend? 8, 10? You know what? Those go in the Democratic Party's column. See, this is the difference. This is the difference between the right-wing radio and normal people radio. This is the difference. Because I will criticize when I see things that are worth criticizing. And it's out there. It is out there in abundance. Arguably, my congressman did the right thing. However, as chairman of the Natural Resources Committee, my congressman, Nick Rahal, had previously done a really, really wrong thing, trying to make it impossible for windmills to be built in West Virginia, because we're going to have to study the environmental impact on bats. Bats. No. I'm not some right-winger. This is screw the bats. The bats don't matter. The bats matter. But in this particular state and in his particular district, when you compare a windmill farm on top of an old abandoned strip mine site, killing a couple or three bats, with what happens when a Hiroshima's worth of explosives goes off on a mountaintop and kills every living thing, somehow the economy of scale doesn't work for me. I mean, for God's sakes, a turkey buzzard flying across a mountaintop removal site has to pack a lunch. No, I'm not kidding. It's a I was listening on my way driving home the other day. I was listening to the public radio program, I think it's from American Public Media, called Living on Earth, and there was a lengthy feature piece on mountain range removal right down there in the Coal River Valley. They talked to our good friend Ed Wiley. They talked to a school teacher who said, well, I'm not worrying about that. No, there was the principal of Marsh Fork Elementary School, this lady who said, well, I'm not particularly worried about the sludge dam failing and 4 billion gallons of toxic goo drowning me. Everybody's got to die somehow. We all have to leave this earth. No kidding. I kid you not. We all have to leave this earth. I'm being told I should register green. I can't register green because I actually want to fight and I want to lead, and those people don't want to lead. They just want to sit and bitch. I want to go the Willie Stark route, for those of you who have read All the King's Men, and I want to find Democrats who will stand up on the stump and say, "Give me the meat axe." Because it is time to clean this party out. I don't care if we, and our good friend Wayne has said the same thing, I don't care if we have to get down to 10% of what is the Democratic Party and start building back from there. We can do it. But a third party system will never, never work in this country until such time as the Constitution is fundamentally altered and amended. You know, some green runs for House of Delegates in this state. I'll vote for him. They run for the state Senate. I'll vote for him. I'll vote for him for governor. I'll vote for him hither, thither, and yon. But no. I understand. I understand. I'm conflicted myself. My head's hurting, and then the thing with Cindy Sheehan breaks, and I don't understand why she chose to go out the way she did. I don't understand it in the least. She has been slimed in so-called liberal Democratic quarters, from Democratic Underground to Daily Coast to hither, thither, and yon. And it's been ugly. And there are those who disagree with her tactics and with her methods. Bart Kopp, in his page today, noted his disagreement with her approach. But at the end of the day, he came down to the same place I think we all have to come down to. She was the only person, when the right wing had the bit in its teeth and was full of oats and full of beans and running full steam ahead, declaring what a glorious patriotic war Iraq was, Cindy Sheehan quietly stood up and said no. The single most powerful word in the English language, no. And she had courage where many others had none. And finally, she has been exhausted, worn out, downtrodden, licked. Let me up, I've had enough, you know, that kind of. And apparently, there was a sleaze fest of some several nasty remarks at Democratic Underground to the point that she felt it worthwhile to mention it. Lord, we don't have to sit around waiting for the Republican Party to divide us. We will do it ourselves. We will do it ourselves. And I don't know why. I'm sure that after Friday's capitulation, there are people out there who are saying, no, really, they're so much smarter than us. They've got it all figured out. They're really going to drop the hammer next time. the time that the Democrats fight back is always coming up. It's always on the horizon.
The sun will come out tomorrow. Bet your bottom dollar that tomorrow there'll be sun. Just thinking about tomorrow clears away the cobwebs and the sorrow till there's none. When I'm stuck with a day that's gray and lonely, I just stick out my chin and grin and say, oh, the sun'll come out tomorrow, so you gotta hang on till tomorrow, come what may.
Sing it! Come on!
I'm stuck with a day that's gray and lonely. I just stick out my chin and grin.
Stick it out!
Now
stick something out. The Democrats will fight someday, tomorrow. It's always a death. A death. Away. Oh, just death. Tomorrow they'll fight back. Tomorrow they'll get a spine. Oh, tomorrow they'll show these warmongering Republican bastard pigs what it's all about. Tomorrow we'll do it. What's the name of that James Bond movie? Tomorrow Never Comes. Die Another Day, too, for that matter. I'm sick. I mean, I'm puking sick. And to see the Democrats then congratulate themselves. I read the Washington Post coverage. Oh, we've got him boxed into a corner this time. Oh, he can't get out of this one. Oh no, next time we're really gonna make him get tough. I mean we've got benchmarks in this bill. Did you know that? We got benchmarks. Did you not see the benchmarks? What's everybody so upset about? There's benchmarks. Well, I did it, didn't I? Every single liberal talker in the entire United States has already covered this topic. I was gone for a few days, and no, I got to get my licks in, too. But it comes from an honest place. Because I didn't get to hear your thoughts Thursday or Friday or Monday. And I know that you're aching just like I am. People have already died. They have died for the love of God. They have died because the Democrats in Congress were too scared to stand up. You know, and let me take a minute here. Let's talk about the Senate side of this just for one second, all right? Because here's how the deal went down in the Senate. The time for voting had almost run out. With Hillary and Barack Obama staring at each other, seeing which one was going to go first and how they'd vote. So finally, Barack Obama went in and voted no. And no sooner had he done so, Hillary came in and voted no. baby. It is wrestling, and the rubes are in the guard armory surrounding the ring, and they're waiting for the great big steel cage death match, aren't they? Lord, Lord, yes. What would have happened if Obama had come in and voted yes? What if Hillary had voted yes first? I don't know. And there's so much more stuff to talk about this evening. There's a new ruling out from the Supreme Court today that is a real gut buster for working people. And that's another one of those glad to be a Democrat moments, because all the all the analysis out there is saying this was a 5-4 decision. It was very close. It could have gone either way. But thanks to Samuel Alito, working people took it on the try to be family oriented here chin today from a family values conservative Republican that was put on the Supreme Court with the connivance of a bunch of gutless, soulless, spineless Democrat senators who wouldn't filibuster, even though the people in the United States, all over the United States, begged them to. No. We got memos. We got speeches. We got statements. We got sound bites saying that senators were receiving letters in support of Alito because he was a good Christian man, and those letters had to be real because they were coming from all over the place, and some of them had donut stains and coffee cup stains on them. Thank you, Senator Byrd. Let's go to the phones. Susan's calling from Oregon. Hey, Susan, welcome to the program.
Get a bucket.
Oh, I've already filled a couple up.
No, you're going to need another one. Ray Hill, Rockefeller, and Byrd all voted for it.
Ray Hall did?
Yep.
Voted yay?
Yay.
Okay, well, that and the windmills, I don't know.
See,
I saw. I was at the network blog, which is a fine blog. People should avail themselves of it more often.
Yeah, well.
But I saw the story and
up on the house.
Well, Susan, the thing was there was this list of we're looking for progressives to run in district XYZ.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that?
Yep.
And I even posted a comment there, and I didn't see Ray Hall in that list. I thought maybe he'd done the right thing.
Well, there's an editorial that I put up. It's called We Expected You to Lose. And it lists everybody who turned traitor, including the people who turned traitor by not voting. The only one who had a reason for not voting was the guy who had a severe brain hemorrhage. He, I figured, had an excuse for not voting. But all the Democrats are up there who voted for the bill or chickened out and didn't vote at all. And they're all up there, and I double checked it with the Senate and House sites, and their names are up there.
Yeah, be damned.
Both of the Washington senators are up there. They're catching all sorts of flack from it. When I went up to Democrats.com to sign the Iraq pledge, this was just after the vote, there were just over 5,000 names on it.
Wow.
And the goal at the time was 10,000. They met that within less than 24 hours. The goal now is 100,000, and they're going to make that easy.
Yeah.
Pledge is very simple. You pledge to support qualified, progressive candidates with your votes and with your money in your district. And when you sign this pledge, it sends it to your delegation. Oops.
A lot
of people are getting these.
I'm a pretty rational fella, Susan. I mean, I don't, You know, I don't want I don't want the workers' paradise created in the United States. I'm not sitting here singing the Internationale. I'm not doing any of that.
I expect them to do what they're told, though.
I want them to represent us.
Yeah, do as you're told, guys. That's what you were elected for.
Yeah. And at least pretend to listen when a constituent who hasn't given you a few million dollars tries to talk to you.
Yeah. But there was one thing that really, really bugged me about that vote. Okay, Joe Biden voted for it, and he said early on he was going to vote for it. And I can respect that. You know, let's face it, that one vote's probably going to cost him any chance of getting into the presidency. But he had the courage of his convictions. I can respect that. What I cannot respect, and I will never respect, is the way Clinton and Obama acted. They did not vote until they knew the bill was going to pass anyway.
Yeah, that doesn't... I was kind of sitting
then
on
they
that,
voted
but
against it.
That is not leadership.
Yeah.
When you are leading, you know, especially the way votes go down in the Senate, you know, they just read the roll call over and over and over again, right?
Yeah.
Dodd
went in and said the day before, I'm against it, I'm voting against it. So did Kucinich. You know, these people laid their reputations on the line.
Yeah.
He said early on.
What is it? Our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. Isn't that
Yeah.
Yeah, because we'll be reading the Declaration of Independence like we do once a year here in another month's time.
Clinton and Obama, I got the impression they would have been just as happy to vote yay.
Sure.
And I want no part of them.
Well, you know, Bart Kopp today noted that he said he thinks he's the only one who's figured it out and no one else has. And it's a trenchant point. He said, I think Hillary and Obama have struck a deal.
I wouldn't be in the least bit surprised.
But Jesus, this you go first. No you, no you, no you, no you.
Uh huh.
Lord. You know, we're looking, and that's what makes the Cindy Sheehan thing so bitter, Susan, is that we're looking for leadership. In the ranks of our politicians, because in America that is frequently where it has come from, and when somebody stood up and sort of by force of moral compunction tried to lead, she was attacked.
Yeah,
she didn't have to. She was just heartbroken. There's a photograph on the cover of the New York Times today. In the lower right-hand corner, showing a young woman, the fiance of a dead American soldier, just laid out prone face down on his grave yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't staged.
No.
That was real. And, you know, every one of these gutless bastards who voted to capitulate to George Bush, because it is, they are gutless bastards.
Yeah. Spineless cowards, every one of them.
You know, what did Shakespeare say? A hero dies but once, a coward dies a thousand deaths. Well, you know, I think that takes on new meaning with something like this. We are a thousand more dead people from last Memorial Day to this Memorial Day. A hero dies but once, a coward dies a thousand deaths. Those thousand deaths they're dying are other people's lives.
Yeah. Just to emphasize what kind of a monster we have running this country. I ran across this stray little factoid when I was watching the Hitler Channel yesterday. And you know how the History Channel runs these things on serial murderers and all this.
Sure, stuff. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so they were doing this serial murder thing. And they were going on and on about this guy, and I'm going, what? So I did some fact-checking on the Internet, and what they said was true. Do you remember Carla Faye Tucker?
Sure.
Please don't kill me. Okay. Please don't kill me.
Yeah, the one that Bush mocked.
Right. Bush, supposedly, he was Mr. Death. With one glaring exception. He commuted the sentence of the damnedest serial killer.
Yeah, from Missouri. I remember that. I'd forgotten.
200 and some women he killed.
Yep, and he got his death sentence
without
commuted.
Without compunction. And he commuted his death sentence.
Yeah.
That's the only one he ever did. This is the guy he chose to spend mercy on. Rather than somebody like Carla Faye Tucker.
Well, let me ask you something. You used the word monster to describe George Bush. Have you ever read the original Bram Stoker Dracula?
Oh, yeah. Hey, that was one of my favorite books when I was a kid. In fact, I was really
okay,
mad
well,
I
you know, the Dracula character is pretty icky. Okay, we've cast George Bush in the Dracula role. But you can't have...
No.
Well, wait, Susan. Wait, Susan. You can't have a Dracula, according to the formula in the book. You cannot have a Dracula without a Renfield.
Oh, yeah. You definitely need the Renfield. You know,
okay, guess what?
The flies.
Guess what?
Hmm.
Guess who Renfield is in this scenario? We've got. I'll give you a hint. We've got a whole... No. We've got a whole Congress full of Renfields out there eating flies. I mean, if you get right down to it, Dracula's kind of elegant and creepy. Renfield is just nasty and craven and soulless and disgusting and depraved.
Yeah, I have to admit, too, you're going to think I'm strange. When I first read Dracula, by the time the end of the book came around, I was really, really peeved because... I was rooting for him.
No, not surprising. Not surprising at all. You know, the creature in Mary Shelley's Frankenstein gets the bum rap.
Yeah.
But what I'm getting at here is who is more Susan is more deserving of our scorn, the hooker or the pimp?
The pimp.
We just played pimp to George Bush's war.
Uh-huh. We've got a whole Congress full of pimps. And that's why I put their names up on the web in that post. And I said, every one of these people needs to be replaced.
Yeah.
And I said in that post, Senator Reid, go home. Stay home. It was so laughable.
This, you know, never mind all the talk about constitutional crisis and blah, 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 if we impeach and all that happy garbage. We are in a crisis, a genuine crisis of leadership. Are
when
we not?
He was making his so-called speech about Democrats will never give in. The chair had to gavel three times just to get people to shut up because there was so little respect for him. Because they were talking over his speech.
Weak tea. That may be the nickname that sticks to him, Susan. Weak tea Reed.
Oh, hey, and it fits. Boy, does it ever.
And it's one of those biblical kind of things, too, because you remember how Big Bad Yahweh said that Pharaoh would pronounce his next curse out of his own mouth? Well, you know, Harry Reid just pronounced his legacy out of his own mouth. Weak T. Reid. We should remember that.
Yeah, and it just... And can you imagine being saddled with that nickname if you're a politician?
Yeah. Well, people have already started mailing him tea bags.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I can go with that one.
You got one you can work with, Susan?
I used one. Used
now, one. Now. We don't anybody know if we're going to send him fresh dry tea or Of course, you know, they live behind the wall.
I'll let it dry first.
Hey, Susan, good to talk to you, dear. You have a wonderful evening.
Yeah, and take care of your lobsterness, remember.
Oh, my, yeah. You know, I put the aloe on my burnt skin, and I can actually hear my skin going, okay, Agnes puts the aloe. I get these looks. We gotta move this show to video sometime.
Agnes just puts the lotion on.
Agnes puts the lotion on its skin.
I would give my eye teeth to be able to see somebody who looks like as the great lobster of the Head On Radio Network.
Oh, I'm she says I'm glowing.
I see.
Yeah, I mean,
Agnes, get a picture. Get a picture.
No, I'm in hiding. I've hidden the camera. Susan, take care.
You too. You have a nice night.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
And onward. Ed is with us. Hey, Ed, welcome to the program.
Hey, good evening, Bob.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I couldn't help but just think about all the events that since the Democrats got in and what a joke they turned out to be. And I said this early on, that I thought Pelosi was a weak person, and I still think it. I don't think she's the person to lead this nation, and you know I think Boxer would have been better than she was.
Well, but Boxer's in the Senate.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I got my head on right starting out, don't I? But anyway,
No, I get your meaning though, and Harry Reid is no better.
That's right. They're you know, you can discern Reid and Pelosi too. I mean, you know that they talk a big game, but they don't put the money out there to back it. I am just so I don't think sick at my stomach is a description for the disgust and all the other things that go with it. Over.
Well, we talk some plain talk on this program. Are they cowards? I mean. Or are they really smarter than us, and they've got a grand strategy to finally beat George Bush?
Well, I would like to think that. I would like to think that they were thinking that they were going to lose this vote anyway or eventually down the road, and that at least they were getting a minimum wage out of it. But the minimum wage could have waited a whole lot better than this war could have, and the killing that's going on, and any of them that watched television yesterday and saw the families and the veterans, the condition that they were in, and George Bush, that hypocrite bastard, making an appearance with these veterans, these young guys that don't understand politics and what George Bush is doing, and acting like they're glad to shake hands with him. They ought to, you know, I'd love to, but I don't want to be one of them for sure because of the condition they're in. But if I was, I'd tell him, get the hell out of my face. And he is a disgusting, low-life coward, and people tend to forget that and overlook it. And then these boys, you know, their mothers get on there, and, of course, they got a – I feel like that their son's done an honorable thing. But in a way, it's defending what George Bush has done to them, has butchered them. And it's disgusting to see the mothers get on there and do the stuff that they do. But I just couldn't watch it all day. It was because I understand what a veteran goes through, and I can't stomach it. But you're talking about Hillary Clinton. You know what? I'd rather vote for a tramp to go in than her or Obama, because it wouldn't have taken nothing for her to support that if she wasn't running for president. And I don't think that Obama was much out of that line. And I still think that Dennis Kucinich or Edwards would make a whole lot better president than either of the, or both of them together, as far as that goes. So I'm just really disgusted with the, and then Senator Byrd and the other guy from Tennessee or Kentucky that's big coal people, anybody that like Pelosi that would let them buffalo her in to not pursue in this.
Well, I want to double check the yeas and nays, but if Ray Hall voted for this, I understand I'm going to have differences of opinion with my elected representatives. They're not going to do what I want all the time. But, there are lines in the sand, aren't there, Ed?
This went over the line. This went farther. You know, we expected more out of those representatives that we have there, especially Rockefeller going into these hospitals and seeing what these veterans look like. How can it not move them? Do they not have a heart?
I have all weekend, I was away from the microphone and everything, Ed. All weekend, I have gone over and over in my head what is motivating these people. And some of it I've seen reading blogs and the various comments, people saying, well, we can't just pull out. We can't just leave the Iraqis in this lurch, because the bloodshed will be terrible. Bloodshed already is terrible.
Yeah.
Bloodshed's going to get worse, whether we're there or not.
Exactly what I was going to say. It ain't going to get no better. It's going to get worse. And it's turning out that way already. Bush is just giving more targets. For sure he's creating jobs, by sending our boys over like that, because, they're not coming back to a job. Number one, they're letting the jobs move out of the country, and so the commitment to the National Guard and so forth is not going to be there. If the companies are not here, how can we guarantee them their job like they're supposed to have when they get back here? It's a damn crying shame what this country has sold everybody down the drain. But
what does it take, Ed? I mean, I'm not trying to be a smartass here. What does it take to get the Democratic Party and the so-called Democratic leadership to understand that we're not kidding? We didn't put them there to watch them play footsie and chess with George Bush. We put them there to have them put a stop to George Bush.
Yeah, well, they know that. They're positively sure there wasn't nothing else to turn the party around for except that very purpose. But yet they're defeating our purpose of what we put. That was the sole reason that I voted all the way that I did.
And I mean, is it just me, or does this strike you as political cowardice of the highest order?
I don't know if it's a political cowardice or an easy way out or not wanting to look bad in the president's eyes. They should be worried about looking bad in the people's eyes, the people that put them in. And I think that every American should write their representatives and let them know how they feel, or email them, or whatever it takes to get the word to them. I'm going to make some more calls tomorrow. But you know what? When you get tough, they don't return a call. I used to get letters back from a couple of them, but I don't even get an answer now. So that tells me that it's full speed ahead.
Well, I'm sitting here looking at the chat room, and our good buddy Ralps in the chat room has posted the link, and yeah, Ray Hall voted aye. He voted yes.
That is, and him,
just like Susan said he did.
Yeah. And that is a disgrace. He went over and tried to act like, he got the name of being a terrorist, or a terrorist supporter, and then him turn around and pull this stuff. Is that his way of creating or hoping to make it look like an imbalance rather than do the job that he was sent to do? But
I don't know. You're a fighter, Ed. You don't back down from stuff. I don't know what to do here. My first inclination is to go out and pull my voter registration, but I realize that that's just a symbolic act and it has no force. My next thought is, they know they're using us. I mean, we're getting played like a 200-year-old fiddle, because they know that most of us Democrats who were raised that way, we will not vote for some godless, soulless, motherless Republican in November, and we're not gonna, and so it'll be a choice between evil and not so evil.
Well,
so what, do we just lay out and let them take an ass whipping and let the Republicans take over?
Until there's a massive And I don't mean a million. I mean till the damn people have a nationwide strike, even if it's for a day, to show them what the tax structure can, how it can be damaged, for not listening to the people, or just simply hitting the streets and staying there. And I know it's a hard thing to do because most people live from payday to payday. But it's just a baffling situation and a sickening one too.
People died for that vote.
Yeah. And, you know, I can't believe it. They forgot what George Bush is, or what they, or that they're overlooking what a cowardly, I'll say anti-American almost, traitor he is. And to see, and to go to those hospitals, you know, and see what he has done, and I call the, Arlington Cemetery the Bush dead people, on demonstration or on,
Display.
On display, yeah. It stops the mind. It stops the mind right there. It does mine. Maybe mine's too little. But I can't get past just those things. I am just absolutely so disappointed in what we got in Washington that, I'm like you are. What do we do? What are we going to do? And, you know, I think you might know further what I don't on what needs to be done.
I don't. I mean, I'm at sixes and sevens, Ed.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just licked on it. I feel like I'm a progressive. I'm a liberal. I'm whatever. You know, whatever. However, we're going to label ourselves. And we have been taken for granted. We have been told to, you know, go piss up a rope. This was the biggest, you know, one-fingered salute from entrenched Democrats to the people who put them in office that I'm aware of in American history.
But don't think that all the Democrats don't feel like you do. That we know we're not getting the service that we voted for. Not, you know, if somebody on the level that I am can see through the scheme, Bob, there's millions of them out there that are sick to their stomach on what's going on. And they're going to be even sicker even before George Bush gets through. You watch what I tell you. They're talking about changing course. If there's anything like that in sight, it's being kept a secret, that's for sure. And I know we're not going to be informed until whatever happens. But still yet, I think we deserve some kind of better action. Not answers, not a committee, and not an investigation, but we need some action. There needs to be something done.
Well, you know, they're not in session all of this week, so there ought to be plenty of time to absolutely wear them out and give them hell.
Yeah.
Well, but you know, that's even doing that, Ed, is closing the barn door after the horses are gone.
Yeah. They're going to reevaluate this thing in September. Well, what happens in September?
In September, General Petraeus is going to tell us that we've turned a corner and that the next 6 months will tell for sure. Because that's the mark. 6 months seems to be the mark that's been used in this war. I saw a list the other day that showed how many times that phrase, the next 6 months, the next 6 months, the next 6 months. And we're six-monthing our way into something that is going to make Vietnam look like child's play.
Yeah. And what they should say is the next 500 that we bury, that should tell the tale, and it should have done been told and over. These veterans, at least it's coming to light how they've treated them, and they're getting some better treatment with legs shot off and so forth. But I am just so disappointed in our party, And you know where I stand. I'm probably not as far left as you might be, but I'm trying to understand it and work my way to that. But for sure, I'm in 100% agreement with what all has been said and what Sue said this evening. It's good to hear people going ahead and speaking out against these. You know, they're mad people. They're absolutely mad. So anybody that could look at the veterans, like I said, keep repeating yesterday, and walk away and not end this thing, are sick. They are sick people.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to chime in and let you know that you had listeners and backers that were as strong against, and you know, I just can't believe Ray Hall went that way. I expected Bird, Bird still is not for protecting the environment, you know. And I heard you say one time on that, that there's plenty of states that have good wages and jobs, and they don't have to worry about coal. Coal is not one of their products. But
well,
they act like, pardon me,
okay.
They act like coal is the very air we breathe down here.
Well, it kind of is, isn't it?
Well, they've made it that way, and they've limited the market. The coal industry don't want for other people to come in and take their prime labor away from them. They're going to keep it like that if they can. And that's probably seems far-fetched to a lot of the listeners, but they want a corner of the market with labor.
Yeah, and they've got a little slave labor market here, and they're quite happy with it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Ed, thank you so much. I always appreciate your thoughts.
Well, we appreciate you, and that goes for hundreds of people, you know, that that hear you. They may not call in, but it's an enlightening thing to hear you talk.
I appreciate it, Ed, so very much. You take care.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.
And I just I got an email in from our buddy Billy Shears. He says, there's only one hope for this country, and the world for that matter. Don't get me wrong, I'd love to see Dennis Kucinich as president, but let's face it ain't happening. So the realistic choice is Al Gore. I don't blame him one bit for being coy, not after what the right did to him. I've watched him on appearances lately, and he's the one, the only logical choice. He has the world's respect. Yeah, he does. He does have the world's respect. I caught a rerun of an interview that he did with Harry Shearer in California over the weekend, and he was brilliant. He always has been. And he wasn't wooden, and he wasn't stiff, and none of that crap that was made up by the right wing about him. Hell, I saw him speak in October of 2000 on the Capitol steps in Charleston, West Virginia, and there was nothing wooden about him. He is a genial, decent man with a damned fine head on his shoulders and a heart to match. And that may be the only hope we have. There will not be a president, and I'm not saying this because of the personalities involved. I'm saying this because of the nature of our history. For the most part, we do not elect presidents out of the United States Senate. Historically speaking, we don't do that because the Senate is designed to be an end in itself. A senator, for God's sakes, gets a longer term of service per term than a president does, with no term limits. It was designed in such a way that when you got to the Senate, it was the pinnacle of one's political aspirations, not the presidency. Because the presidency was designed as a relatively powerless thing, as compared to the powers of the purse and the legislative and contemplative powers of the Congress. The presidency was looked upon as a demotion of sorts. We will not, the Democratic Party, will not elect a president from the United States Senate. I don't know if nobody told Hillary and Barack this and Chris Dodd and Joe Biden. I don't know, but it ain't going to happen. It's not going to happen. Dennis Kucinich, Al Gore, and John Edwards right now are the best we've got to offer. Let's go to the phones. Albert is calling from Wisconsin. Hey, Albert, welcome to the program. Hello?
Good afternoon, Bob. How are you?
Well, you know.
Yeah.
Thank you for the geniality.
How should I start this? I hate to say it, but...
Take your time. If you need, we'll carry over after the news. Don't worry.
All right. Excellent. I feel like I hate being right. That's all I can say. I hate being right. I'm sick and tired of being betrayed. I'm sick and tired of what they keep doing. And I just, real quick, before I get off into my rampage, yes, my baby, before I get off into my rampage, I just kind of wanted to say I thank you for reenumerating the fact that the Senate is an end. And that we, like, because every time I don't watch TV, as you know, but when I do catch the clips online, all these pundits are always talking about how the Senate is a training ground for the presidency. And the sad thing is I think...
That's BS.
It is. It's total BS. And I think that's one of our big problems with why we don't get anything done. Because they're always worried about their next step. You know, and that's our biggest problem here. They're sitting there and, you know... These guys, they're given. What do they think they're doing with this Iraq stuff? I mean, I've wanted to talk to you for a while. It hasn't been, and there hasn't had the time. But I mean, what have these guys been doing? What are they thinking? Talk about you want to talk about reinforcing the worst stereotypes of the Democratic Party? Well, just go ahead and do it because that's what they're doing. That's exactly what they're doing. Oh, they're a bunch of wimps. Oh, they have no backbone. They can't stand. On you know on their principles or anything like that, and they're making people like Rudy Giuliani look like they actually have, excuse me, I'm trying not to choke as I say these words, have more integrity than the Democratic Party in whole.
Well, it's clear that among others, oh boy, and you want to talk about choking because I mean most of his policy positions are crazier than a sprayed roach, but Ron Paul has more integrity.
I know.
That's not to say I'd ever vote for him for president. I mean, if it came down to like Ron Paul versus Rudy Giuliani, and that was it, you know, maybe.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, you know, he's one of these, you know, poor people are poor because God wants them to be types, you know, libertarian nonsense.
He does, but he does also he's like almost. If we're going to categorize him, I'd almost call him the Republican Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah. No, it's valid. You know, both out of the House, both they both got anti-war credentials going back to before George started it. It's this hunger. It is Albert. Tell me if I'm wrong. There's a yearning for hunger, a taste for hunger that it's literally in our mouths.
You're not wrong. We there's been a hunger since 2000. Okay. And I have to agree with you on the whole Al Gore deal. I really do hope that he's just playing a game so he doesn't get preempted and he does come in. And I've kind of felt that for, like, whole fact of the nocturnal emissions that a Hillary nomination would bring to the Republicans, just because, man, they've been gunning for her for 15 years. So I really do hope that, and I've been thinking this for a while, that ever since we've always been hearing this and hearing it and hearing it, that she is a dark horse. And she does kind of just, you know, kind of clear some path and, you know, basically act as a landmine roller. And that way, when Al Gore finally does realize that, you know, we are screaming for him and that this country and the world needs his sanity and his gravitas, when he does come onto the issues, I really do. Michael Moore said it on Real Time with Bill Maher, how he thinks that the country would like to redeem itself for 2000. So, and I'd have to agree. I mean, I remember when Al Gore ran the first time, and I mean, of course, my name's Albert, so yeah. And his though's his. So I kind of, you know, as a kid when he does, I was younger when that time, but. And then I lost some faith in him, and then he started speaking out at MoveOn.org and all these little things against the Iraq War back before anybody was doing it, while I was sitting there, but, you know, anybody of, you know, stature was doing it, and I was sitting there, and I was loving him, because he was almost a frothing lunatic, because he knew what you and I know, what everyone here listening knows, and even the Republican lurkers that are sitting in the back corners, that they know that, yeah, another 6 months, you know what another 6 months is going to give us? It's going to give us another 600 dead.
Yeah.
Because we have been sitting there averaging over 100 dead troops every month. So that's what we're going to get. We're going to get another 600 dead.
And and don't forget, Albert, it's going up. May was the bloodiest month of 2007. Before that, April was the bloodiest month of 2007.
Yeah. It's amazing.
And they're saying that this is the price of our surge because they're fighting back harder. And one of those goofy-ass generals said, well, you know, there's a war going on out there. Yeah, it's a war we chose to have, you fool. Yeah. Yeah. See, I'm sorry. This is your nickel.
No,
don't
be. You almost want to bite your tongue off because, I mean, nobody listens when you talk, and then when it happens, it's just like, what?
Well, what we're doing here, this is kind of living proof of the antithesis of that. We're all talking. We have made ourselves abundantly clear, Albert.
True.
We have made it plain. We've made it, you know, no bones about it. There's nothing. There's nothing for these mugwump, lily livered, the simpering Democrat. I don't even know what to call them. There's no way that they can. Oh, I'm sorry. We thought you meant you wanted us to reach a negotiated solution to bring the war to an end with George Bush. We thought you wanted us to do this in gentlemanly fashion according to the Marcus of Queensberry rules. We're so sorry. We were mistaken. Oh, you meant get out now. There's no way they can do that.
It's amazing. It's simply absolutely. It's mind-bogglingly amazing. I don't even comprehend how they think that we could sit there and continue to sustain. I mean, what are these dinos doing? I mean, and I count Hillary
getting rich.
I mean, and that's the other thing. You know, real quick, I just wanted to touch base. You know, Barack Obama, for as you know, as much as people like him for his charisma and everything else like that. He has only served, what, one term in the Senate?
Not even.
No, he needs to go sit back down and do something else. Okay?
He's been in the United States Senate since January of 2005.
Yeah. And what does he do? You know, and I'm not, you know, and I'll tell you what he does, is he's a politician. And the same thing that all these other corporate politicians, and that's what they are, there are corporate candidates. Right, they got the backing of the corporate, you know, military, media, industrial complex. Okay, they have this backing, so like all of a sudden, that's all we hear. We only hear these people. We only hear, oh, Barack and Hillary, and you know, and then Rudy, and then the Republicans have their, you know, corporate candidates and all that other stuff. And it's probably going to be who, Mitt Romney, because he's got the look.
Well, yeah, Mitt Romney is the emptiest empty suit.
Oh my God.
They couldn't clone George Bush or get George another 4 years. So I'd say Romney has the inside track. Giuliani, the fundies won't support Giuliani. The Republicans who fancy themselves as even a little bit sane won't support McCain. I think you're going to see that. I'd say Romney's got the inside track. Now, what are we going to put up against Romney? Hillary, Obama, Edwards.
I do like Edwards, and
I like Edwards too. Edwards,
clean as clock, but I think Gore. I really do. I just do. I mean, Al, if you're listening, you better do it.
I think you know, he talks about, you know, his love affair with politics has ended and blah 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 blah. But I think that he's got enough integrity that if he sensed, I think where Al is coming from is the old adage, the old Roman adage about Cincinnatus in his fields. You know, he was literally plowing in his field. He had retired, and gone back to his country estate, and they came to him and said, "You got to do it. You've got to do it, not because you want it, but because Rome is absolutely at death's door. You've got to do it." And that's where the legend of Cincinnatus dropping his plow and going to Rome and do it. And then he left again and went back to his plow. I think that is the model that Al Gore is operating on.
I hope so. And it would be nice to see. Well, I don't know how do you say this, because you bring up the Roman analogy, and to me that's a thorn bush. So,
well, sure it is. You know, you mentioned the Senate thing. Part of the problem, I think, with senators who want to be president is they're mistaking the American political system, Albert, with the what was referred to back then as the cursus honorarium. Which was, you know, there was literally a ladder that one climbed, and you were a praetor, and then you were another, maybe you were urban praetor, and then you worked your, you know, but eventually you worked your way up to the point where you were the where you stood for the consulship, and things happened by certain ages. I think Cicero became consul when he was 43 years old. He was right on track.
Yep.
And it was laid out that way. And I think the Obamas and the Hillarys and the Bidens and the Dodds of this world see a sort of cursus honorarium as existing in the federal government, where it does not exist, Albert.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I do think... yeah, I do have to agree with that. I mean, another thing... that I'm sitting here and I'm just kind of batting around in my head, just because I just finished the book Nemesis by Chalmers Johnson, and it didn't really enlighten me in terms of anything new, but it did kind of sum it up in a way that I think it made it a little bit easier to debate it. Yes, my beauty. Yeah, you're having fun. It's a beautiful day out, so go enjoy.
Oh,
it.
Oh, we're glad.
Yeah, about time, for summer's finally here.
Yeah, with a vengeance. I'm so red from doing yard work yesterday. I can hardly stand to move.
Yeah, no, I totally understand that. But my, just the fact that we are a republic, and that we should, embrace that. I mean, we can't fight with it, so we might as well embrace it. One of the things that Chalmers Johnson kind of said about it in his book was that we're coming to this point where we're going to have to... We're coming to the same point that the Roman citizens had, where we're nice and comfortable, everything's great, blah, 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 but we're going to have to choose whether we want to keep our republic or keep our empire.
Because we can't have both.
Exactly, and we can't have both. And, I mean, and as you see right now, Bob... That's what we're looking at right now. That's what is happening to this country right now. These Democrats if we're on the radio, the words would fly out, but these people are scoundrels. They are disgusting people that don't even have the slightest clue as to, I mean, maybe they do. Do they know where we're headed? Because I see it. I know you see it. Mm-hmm. There's a cliff. And there's jagged rocks at the bottom of it, because that's where we're going. If we continue this stuff, and if we continue what we're doing, I mean, you know, just speak about Ron Paul, you know, just to bring that back a second, yeah. If, you know, the fact that we were attacked on 9/11, okay, is because of what we're doing in these countries. And I don't know, you know, Rudy likes to play the whole, ooh, how could you do you say
I demand
that
you retract that statement, you know. Oh. Kiss me.
Yeah. And I don't want to incite, incite violence, but, you know, give me a break. You know, you're hurting my intestinal tract when you say something like that, that you're that ignorant to the fact that you don't even understand why we're getting attacked, why they do hate us. You know, like, and if you think that, you know, we're going to fix the problem of why they hate us by installing another puppet empire, you know, proxy regime, in Iraq, if you think that's going to fix and solve, and they're not going to come here, Bob, what do you say to this, Bob? I don't even know what to say.
There's something that's been sort of wandering around my head ever since Susan mentioned that my congressman, Nick Rahal, voted for this atrocity. Because I have to wonder why he did it. This is a man, Albert, this is a man who got on a plane and flew to Baghdad as the war was being prepped to try to find some way to make this not happen. He was excoriated among the knuckle-walking, mouth-breathing, redneck, weirdo, freakazoid electorate in this district and called things like Nick Al Beckley and Baghdad Nick, okay? I was on the air in Beckley at the time, and I went to bat for the man and said, how dare you punks refer to him this way, okay? And now I'm the one with the shiv in my ribs. All right, but let me see if I can work through this, Albert, because you're a sharp cookie, and you'll stop me if I'm getting it wrong. You know, from time to time, and in fact, Nick Rahal was on this program the last time when they passed the real bill that would have put some checks and balances on George, the one he vetoed, the one that they should have sent back the same damn way.
Yeah.
He said in an interview on this program that there was also language in the original bill that would have prevented George Bush from being able to expand the war to Iran without further congressional approval, but that language was pulled by virtue of AIPAC, and AIPAC promised to destroy the whole bill if that language stayed in there. Okay.
Now it makes a little more sense.
Oh, well, no, it's about to make even more.
Okay.
We got lots of people who take lots of AIPAC money. Nick Rahal's not one of them in the Congress. Nick is of Lebanese extraction. All right? And this is not racial. This is not geographical. It is geopolitical.
Mm-hmm.
We have had two trips or more by high-level Bush administration officials to be literally called on the carpet before the king of Saudi Arabia. And this is the one thing that has sort of penetrated my mind in the last hour or so. I'm wondering if some of this doesn't have to do with the Saudis. Because, you know, the Saudis came out and said that this was the king himself, I do believe, said that this occupation is illegal and immoral and counter-religious or whatever. But they have also said that if we just bail out, that they will fund the Sunnis to fight off the Shiites in Iraq. Are you following me?
Yeah, I'm following you.
I'm wondering if this has to do with that. I'm wondering if this has to do with a message sent through saying that, you know, we can't leave yet because the boss said we can't. And here's the sickening part. The boss, the people that boss the United States government around, the people who represent we the people, okay, the boss of the Congress and the executive department are, in this order, AIPAC and the Saudi and the Royal House of Ibn Saud. Okay, I'm not talking any trilateral commission, Illuminati's. No. This is the people. This is the people who control the religion industry in this country, namely AIPAC.
Yep.
Because they've got the Hagees and the Dobsons and rotten hell Falwell. They've got that wrapped around their fingers. And on the other hand, you've got the Royal House of Ibn Saud, who control the gas pump.
Now, I think that's a valid. I think that seed is a valid one. And I'm sorry about the screaming. But
oh, don't worry about it.
They're having fun. At least they're having fun.
Yeah, let them have it while they can, brother.
Exactly. One day, Daddy's gonna have to sit down and have a long talk with them about the world.
Yeah.
But not today.
No.
But we'll sit there, and, you know, I do think that is a valid point. Another thing that I was kind of, that's been a little seed that's been bumping around in my head is that, in terms of just politically in this country, that perhaps, even though they take the AIPAC money, and even though your seed kind of trumps mine, I'm kind of thinking in a way that it also is an aspect in terms of to manipulate the voting populace, that that what the Democrats, that that the flack they're going to get now in compared to what's going to happen in 6 months. I mean, Bob, there ain't going to be no changes in 6 months.
No.
Right now.
Wait. There's going to be changes six times. There's going to be a half a thousand more families shattered beyond all recognition in this country, and probably 50,000 more families shattered beyond all recognition in Iraq. That's big change, brother. Let's not overlook that.
It is, and I totally understand that. I was talking positive.
Yeah.
I was talking positive change.
No, we're gonna turn another one of those corners. We've turned so many corners, we've worn the corners smooth. It's a circle now.
Well, yeah, we keep making corners. We keep, yeah, exactly. We're going circles.
Damn NASCAR by now, you know. Going fast and turning left or turning right or, yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. But one of the things that maybe perhaps, because there won't be any positive change, and because that maybe some people, more and more people will see, and maybe Bush's approval rating will finally hit to the 15% where it really belongs. And it's belonged since he was put into office. Perhaps, though, what will happen is that's what they're counting on. This is like a presidential 2008. They're counting on that. The fact that there isn't, it's an insurgency. There is going to be no change like that. I mean, I'm just sitting there, you know, even the U.S. troops are realizing that they're sitting there training the people during the day that turn around at night and attack them. So, yeah, there is going to be no positive growth in this, and I'm sorry, people. I'm sorry for the family.
Did you catch the story over the weekend about down in one of the formerly British areas or whatever, an entire brigade of police just gone? Not killed, just left. Now, there's a story that comes out today that a bunch of Iraqis wearing police uniforms busted into a secure compound. Here it is. Gunmen wearing police commando uniforms abducted several Western civilians from a finance ministry compound in Baghdad today. And see, it's hard to pull these things together, and maybe it's strictly coincidental. But there were a bunch of Iraqi cops who just went, you know, off the AWOL, whatever you want to call it, just, you know, gone, you know. And then today you've got a bunch of people in cop uniforms going into we're talking about inside Baghdad, into the finance ministry compound.
Which is in the green zone, I take it. Not that I live there, but,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah, but they, and carried off several, no given number, several Western civilians.
Nice. Really?
A good friend of mine noted the other day, Albert, that probably some component of something near 100% of the IEDs that blow up probably have some component in them that was manufactured in the United States for the prosecution of this war against the people, and because, you know, these are folks fighting a so-called insurgency, they're fighting an occupation, whatever it, and they will turn your stuff on you.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's probably an American component in every IED that goes off, and I think that's 100% likely. You know, we leave Hummers, we leave Bradley fighting vehicles abandoned by the side of the road because, you know, because a tire blows up and we don't have the supply chain to fix them. We just have to abandon them. And you know what? They don't stay abandoned very long, Albert. They get pulled away, wheeled away, and as it was said to me, three of ours make one of theirs. And the next thing you know, you've got an equipped fighting force.
Yeah. Oh, it doesn't. I mean, well, that's the whole thing, right? I mean, you know, just the fact that this whole entire invasion was a complete and utter
fraud.
And I don't want to use the word retarded but it is. It's retarded.
It's
in the terms of the dictionary definition of the word. It was retarded. All we did, and I know you and I were probably some of the lone voices in the wilderness sitting there screaming about, we want to go in there to control the supply of oil. Oh, you're so full of it, blah, blah, blah. He's got weapons of mass destruction.
Where's my where's my dollar a gallon gasoline if it was about controlling the oil?
Bingo. But that's the point.
Oh, baby, it was about the $3 gasoline, trust me.
Exactly. That's what they want because they make the bigger profit on it. And, you know, this is kind of leading me into really what another thing that I would like to discuss with you for a second. But first, you know, yeah, I mean, they're even talking about, did you hear about the fact that the IEDs that were under concrete and it flipped a Stryker vehicle right on its side, right on its back or whatever have you? It was under the concrete. Now, basically what that means is that's a powerful explosion.
That ain't Wile E. Coyote pouring the gunpowder birdseed in the middle of the road and putting the sign in it.
Exactly. And it's also kind of what it reminds me of, and what I don't forget, is I don't forget when they actually, remember when the only places we did secure, and I know this is a big beef with you when we did, again, it's a big beef with myself and many others that actually care about culture and humanity, when they didn't secure the museums and so on and so forth and the sites, but they also sat there and they only secured, you know, the oil fields and the oil ministry. Well, they sat there with that and they let this whole entire huge, I don't even remember, do you remember how many of the tons it was, but it was like millions of tons of high-grade explosives just walk out of the bases that Saddam had. So that's another aspect of it, and I'm sure, you know, you're sitting there, just like in Vietnam, when the little Vietnamese washwomen would sit there and slip a hand grenade with duct tape wrapped around it, and the pin pulled out, and they'd slip it in the Huey's gas tanks. You know, just like that's happening, you don't think that's we're sitting there arming people because we want to make them Iraqis police themselves and protect themselves. Yeah, we're sitting there giving them all this armaments, and they're turning around and using it back on us.
Well, you know, when they stand up, we'll blow up.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But I'll tell you, you know, and another thing that this is where I think this is another root issue in terms of, especially us here on the left, and we have to convince those on the right and so on and so forth, but we really, seriously, now more than ever, it's more now than yesterday than it was yesterday, we need alternative fuels. We need it so bad it's not even funny. Okay, we need alternative ways so we can sit there and the people that do have jobs that are 50 miles away and they can come back and, you know, they need to take these jobs because it pays what they need to pay. We need to sit there and be able to kind of finagle this. Well, you know, as you know, we're over here, we're second and third shift people in this household.
Yeah.
So, you know, the people that we're the invisibles where, you know, stores don't pay attention, nobody pays attention. We have to work our lives around that. You know, but we sitting there, and I woke up. I only slept for a little bit, but sometimes my wife was working, and when she's not at work, sometimes I like to, you know, fall asleep with the radio on. You know, it's the BBC at night, and I listen to it and so on. And I woke up in the morning, and I was listening to another show on NPR. I know. But I don't get the horn or anything.
No. I have great fun at the expense of NPR. I remember when they were a legitimate, fairly straightforward news outlet. But yeah, go ahead. No, it's okay.
So, no, and what happened was is I heard almost, and I was having a deja vu experience, like unbelievable. I wasn't sure that if I heard this radio show five times or it was just I was listening to the one that I heard 2 or 3 years ago, because it was the same exact deal, and they had their guest. Her guest was a guy from the Center for American Progress, and he keeps talking and talking about alternative fuels, and he wakes me up, and he's sitting there, and he's aggravating me, and I sat there, he's aggravating me, because I'm sitting there going, you know, all right, he's talking about corn, okay?
Oh, dear.
And guests would call up and say, you know, guests would call up and say, well, you know, the fact that, you know, we're making more ethanol and so on and so forth, that makes that the corn that we eat and the food that we make, you know, because now that raises the price of the corn and so on and so forth, you know, it's not really an alternative. And nobody really challenged him on the fact that corn is a bad alternative.
Because it takes, it's like, on the grander scale, it's like fusion. It takes more energy to create it than it creates.
Just about. Hopefully one day when we finally realize some of the things about the greatest band in the universe, which, oh, yeah, the Horn needs a science show, because I would love that. But what we, in terms of the fringes and stuff, but what we really do, once we finally realize these things, and maybe one day fusion would be the deal. But the thing is, and I'm going to just give you a couple of little facts here. You know, and this is, I'm not entirely sure if this accounts for the petroleum that's used in generating the corn. But I know that the fact that the energy input that we get from oil, for example, is 10 to 1. It takes, you know, for one unit of energy that we put in, we get 10 out.
Yeah.
Okay. With corn, it's 0.8. 0.8. Now, that's a loser.
Yeah.
It's a loser. I don't care how you look at it. It's a loser. It can't do it.
Right. Well, exactly. And that's what makes me so crazy about, again, my congressman, chairman of the Natural Resources Committee, who recently moved to change the rules on wind power. So that every wind project anywhere now has to have bat studies and bird studies and do anything. Because, you see, a phone call went into Nick Rahal's office. And that phone call came from, the head of the coal association or some such.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're killing us here with this wind energy. Next thing you know, we won't need to be burning coal.
Oh, no.
Then where's your economy going to be in West Virginia when you don't have all those millions of jobs from coal mining?
Well, hey, if you guys stop cutting your hills down, maybe you could put some turbines on top of them.
Actually, the Greenbrier windmill project is going on top of, in part, a big old abandoned strip mine.
Oh, hey, at least they're putting something positive out of
it. Where nothing but grass lives anyway. But, you know, I mean, that's the way it works around here. You know, carbon energy is a weapon unto itself, Albert.
I agree. I totally agree.
It is a weapon that coal producers in the United States use on the people of the United States, and it is a weapon that the people of Iran and Iraq and Saudi Arabia and that miserable little backwater over there use on the people of the United States. Now, the sooner we figure out a way to lessen the dependency on that, then the sooner we stop pouring our blood and treasure out of this country. You know, most of our trade deficit is made up of oil.
Oh, Bob. And that's why. And that's
it's not
why.
All Chinese crap coming to Walmart from, you know, it's oil.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, indeed. And that's why I was actually, and that really brings me right back to why I was telling my story about how NPR woke me up with all this disturbing news. What they did was they made me have to call them. Now, here I go. And I call up NPR, and I sit there, and I sat there, and I got on, and I was the last guest on, and, you know, NPR isn't like the Horn. The Horn's beautiful. I love this radio station, because when I call you and I talk to you, I actually get to talk to you. And NPR, you got to be like,
it's auctioneer radio.
Oh, it's unbelievable. You have no time to say anything. They cut you off. They do this, they do that, and this. But, however, there is an alternative. There is a viable alternative, and it's not going to give us the 10-to-1 return that oil does. We're going to have to, you know, tighten our belts a little bit and, you know, maybe resole our shoes. But it will work. And it will work on a grand scale, and it will work everywhere. And it can work in West Virginia, and it can work here in Wisconsin, and where, actually, in my little town of Westby, where I live, we do get wind power. Like, that's where we get a lot of our energy, which is, you know, because a bunch of hippies out here. But anyway.
Yeah, go hippies.
Yeah, they love their wind power. But, you know, we sit here,
poor little
and I'm
birds.
Hemp. I got to say it, Bob.
Yeah. Oh, no. I'm going down the road, and I'm hearing this story about a North Dakota state legislator.
The Indians.
No, it's not the Indians. This guy's a state legislator in North Dakota who is having a fit trying to get North Dakota farmers enabled to raise hemp because they're getting their asses handed to them by the Canadians, who are raising it and making a fortune on it.
Yes.
And he said, you know, it's too late now. He said, the corner of my property that I use for experimental crops and whatever, I've prepped it. It's ready to go. Planting season is over. And the DEA said, we're sorry, we cannot certify. And, you know, and the guy in this, you know, and please, dude, this is not some guy in a tie-dyed T-shirt sitting there kicking a hacky sack and eating a cheese sandwich, okay? This is one of those, you know, North Dakota farm fellers.
Yep.
And he said, you know, if somebody tried and came into my fields and tried to smoke some of my industrial hemp, they'd get a sore throat and a headache.
Headache, exactly. And exactly, and you know what? I mean, besides the whole fact, the whole recreational aspect of the of hemp's cousin cannabis, which is, oh, it's so horrible, as I sit here with a new Glarus hot day in my hand.
Yeah, I knew you'd find a way to get to stick the knife in.
I got to get you. I got to send you something.
It's deja brew. We've all been beer before.
Yeah. But, you know, seriously, it's hemp. Hemp, you know, I'll tell you, the return to hemp, you know what the return is? And this is it without even the newfangled cellulose, you know, extraction, so on and so forth,
yeah.
Ethanol. The return to hemp is 3-1.
Wow.
And in the plant kingdom, that's good. I mean, that's...
Oh, no, that's exceedingly good.
Yes, that's 3-1, and it's hemp. And hemp grows everywhere. And I really wanted to say this because I want the America, because it's like, when I said this to that guy from the Center for the America Progress, whatever his name is, when I said this to him, you know what he said to me, Bob? I got this is the second time in this conversation I've had chills, and I had chills. I actually didn't have chills. I had shivers because it was so disgusting. He said to me, oh, I never heard of that. You never what? You're sitting here looking at alternative fuels, and you've never heard of hemp? What, are you kidding me? This is the only plant that we can use. Switchgrass my foot. Any of this stuff my rear. You're
and it's delightfully easy to farm.
It's huge. In Wisconsin, where I am right now, we can manage two crops. This is Wisconsin, okay? So if I can manage two crops here in
you've got a two planting season up there for hemp?
Yes.
Jesus.
Two.
Yeah, let's not grow any of that.
But in
all truth, it was mentioned in this report that I listened to that West Virginia is among the states that is pressing for agricultural hemp legislation and has it underway. But of course, it's where we're doing something right. I'm sure you've got the coal industry burning up the phone lines to the White House. And, well, you know, them hillbillies will be smoking that stuff.
Oh, you know, I'm going to tell you another thing. You know, and that brings me to a whole other aspect of it. But, you know, I'll tell you right now, Bob, you know, I'm going to tell you my whole, because I think about this stuff. I mean, I think about it when I sleep. Okay, so, I mean, this is something that we need as America. And I'm glad West Virginia is doing it. I know we do have some little people that are actually, you know, big people, but they're little because there isn't many of them. And we have, and they do have influence, but we can overcome these people, and we need to, because hemp is really going to be the only thing, and I hate to be, you know, a fanatic about it, about anything, but I've looked at all the research, and until the aliens come down and give us, you know...
The Frisbees and the wheat checks.
Yeah, exactly, and they give us the free energy, you know, and until that happens, hemp is going to be the only thing. Okay, that is going to enable the survival of the human species.
Which brings me to another point, if I may, real quick.
Go ahead, please.
You want to know somebody else who is calling the DEA, going, they're going to smoke it. That would be Monsanto, because they don't. Because
oh, yeah.
You see, you don't need Roundup Ready hemp.
Oh yeah, exactly.
You don't. You don't need pesticide proof hemp, because hemp is, after all, a
natural pesticide. That's what THC is.
It's also a weed.
It's a weed, yeah, exactly.
It's a very, very successful weed. It outweeds the other weeds.
Exactly. And, you know, that's the other thing. And I'll tell you another thing. I'm glad we're having this conversation because, you know, this is an important conversation. This is a conversation that everybody who's listening to this, you really need to go educate yourselves on this stuff because this stuff is important.
They have fairs where they sell hemp milk.
Oh, this hemp, butter, hemp, everything. And I'll tell you another thing in terms of, I mean, you don't talk about...
And by the way, those oils are omega-3 and omega-6s.
Exactly, and I just wanted to talk about this because, you know, as we're sitting there killing our oceans with plastics that look like phytoplanktons, and we're sitting there killing our oceans with these giant 500-foot-long nets, and we're sitting there thinking we could take and take and take. Well, I'm telling you, hemp is the only plant that has the perfect ratio of amino acids for human consumption, okay? And I'll tell you, this plant is going to actually help save not even the species so much as the world. right, we have all this grass and all this other stuff in terms of on the highways, and you know, you drive down the highway, you drive down I-90 or 95 or any of these roads, you see, you have this giant space in between for expansion, but it's also there and there's nothing there but grass. Well, why can't we grow our fuel there? We can get three types of fuel from hemp.
Well,
we can get diesel. So the trucks and the factory and the tractors and all that stuff that harvest it and the combines and all that stuff, they can power it by the what they're harvesting in terms of the hemp.
Mm-hmm.
We get ethanol and methanol, okay? And we get it in higher yields than we'll get from any other plant.
And, you know, you mentioned the middle of the roads. I don't know how it is there in Wisconsin, Albert, but the same thing applies. A lot of the space, and, you know, I was on a little bit of a drive this weekend. A lot of those neutral spaces between the highways were populated with these beautiful poppies.
Oh, well, those are legal. You can grow them.
Sure they are. But that's the same thing. I mean, where's the DEA? Oh, you know, the freaks are going to be out there trying to make opium out of them poppies, even though they're not even an opium poppy. It's the same thing with industrial hemp.
Oh, it's actually. Let me correct you.
But I mean, you see what I'm saying.
Yeah, I do see what you're saying, but I got to correct you on this one, just for everybody's mind, right? And everybody that is listening, because it's not just you and I here, right? The fact is, okay, I can right now grow opium poppies in my garden, and the DEA has nothing to say about it at all. They have nothing to say about it. The only thing that they say, the only clause about it is just the fact, and I can cut them. I can cut the bulbs, and I can take all the little pods, okay, and I can put them, because they use this floral arrangements. Okay?
Oh, for God's sakes, you're right. I'd forgotten all about that. I read that.
Yeah, but hemp, you can't get high off it. You can't get enlightened off it. Nothing.
And brownies made with it taste like crap.
Exactly. All you can do with it, okay, and that's another aspect in terms of America, but I'm going to tackle this hemp issue, because this hemp issue isn't a dark horse for marijuana legalization.
No.
Okay, for cannabis legalization. It's not. Even though that should be as well, because... we'll get into that another time.
Yeah, boy, that's another one.
Yeah, that's a big, long one. But I'll tell you, you know, this is the thing. This hemp is sitting there and is going to... We're going to be able to eat it, wear it, drive on it. There's so many things you can do. We can build our houses with it. The concrete, right? The Romans, when they finally did go into... Now, France... Yeah, right? France built all this concrete, and they have all these concrete things from the Roman days. And that concrete is still there in good shape. Why? Because it had hemp in it. Because hemp is one of the... It is. Actually, not one of. It is the best material for us humans to use in terms of building. It's flexible. It's bendable. It's long-lasting. It's so super strong. I mean, we're sitting here looking at a thing where we could have an entire industry overnight. Overnight in this country. It wouldn't even take a year. Because back in the day, when they first made marijuana and hemp, they actually made hemp illegal. And the reason that marijuana is illegal is because hemp is so useful. Okay? And it doesn't need all the petrochemicals and the fertilizers and the pesticides and all the stuff that corn and soy and all the other nonsensical things do. Okay? And I'll tell you another thing. I'll tell you another real quick thing, because this is one of these things that I get a burr in my butt from it. You know, people, they talk about, oh, soy protein, boy, blah, blah, blah. You know, soy brings up allergic reactions in human beings.
And then there are the phytoestrogens.
Exactly. And soy, okay, well, I'm sure in minimal doses it's all right. But soy traditionally has only been used as a green manure in China. Okay? They used it, they only ate it during times of famine. Okay? And its yields are nowhere near as high as hemp. But hemp is the choice food for the human body to consume. Because of it has more digestible protein, it has, well, as I said earlier, it had all the amino acids that we need.
The inert fibers, yeah.
Fiber, I mean, we're talking about something that...
Fatty acids.
Yeah, exactly. All these fatty acids that, you know, we talk about high cholesterol and so on and so forth. And you know, it does take a little bit to get used to eat it, but it isn't, once you do acquire that taste, it's delicious.
Sure.
And once you, it is, it really is. Hemp seeds in anything. And I'm one of those kind of people, and I get this from my grandfather from...
Oh, the little co-op that doesn't exist across the river. I used to go in there and buy these wasabi-flavored hemp seeds things.
Oh, ooh, really?
Yeah, and they were wonderful, man. They were yummy.
I love anything with wasabi, but that's just wasabi. Yeah.
Hey, Albert, I got to roll on, but man, what a great conversation! Thank you so much, and we will cover this ground because it's ground. It needs to be talked about, and it needs to be. And I hate to say this, because I don't want to piss people off, but it needs to be de-hippied.
It does. It'll get us out of Iraq.
Because that's where the DEA comes from, is that, I mean, like the guy in North Dakota, they were insisting that he provide them with precise GPS locations of everywhere a hemp seed was going to grow in the ground.
Really? You know?
And that they had to he had to provide them with genetic profiles of the hemp that he planned to plant. And then there's the DEA spokesman who says, well, you know, there's a lot of these people who think this is going to be a backdoor for marijuana legalization.
Oh,
and you know, they think that, well, you know, they'll plant their hemp, but, you know, in the middle, they'll have a couple of really tasty plants going for their own personal consumption.
Okay, Bob, two things real quick, and then I'll say goodbye.
Okay.
Number one, you can't grow Sensimilia cannabis sativa in with hemp because it'll pollinate it and it'll turn it into
I know.
Hemp. Okay, and number two, the founding fathers of this country smuggled hemp out of India, okay, Indian hemp seed. They smuggled it. They wanted it because they knew how useful it was.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Everybody, I love you all. Talk to you later.
See
you,
Albert.
Keep fighting a good fight, Bob.
Hey, enjoy that brew, brother.
Always. Bye-bye.
Later. Yeah, about 19 minutes before the hour, share a quick email with you. I just got this in from our good friend Sue on Big Coal River. Talking about Congressman Rahal there, she says, I called Mr. Rahal's office, not that I got an answer to my question. I asked why he and the rest of the Democrats were so spineless that they voted for the bill to give more money to the war in Iraq. I also asked why they let down the people that voted for them because we wanted the change they promised. I asked why they sided with the idiot in the White House who started this stupid, senseless war. I didn't get an answer. She didn't even say she would pass on the message. Get out of the way. We know you'll vote for us in November when there's a bigger freak than me running against me. That's why primaries are so important. I'm being told by Agnes we've got to take a break. You want to get involved with it? Well, we've got a conversation coming with Paul Waldman, senior fellow at Media Matters for America, very presently after the top of the third hour. But there's plenty of time left for conversation as well. If you want to get in on it, you know the phone numbers. This is the Head On Radio Network, America's liberal voice. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Flashing red warnings, unseen in the rain. This thing has turned into a runaway train. Long distance phone calls, a voice on the line. Electrical miles, it's off in the time. Dynamite too is hooked on the wire. And so are the rails of American.
The United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competency and training. UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service, giving you the best in business anytime and every time. It's their job to provide manpower. They build partnerships based on respect and trust. They provide skilled, responsible millwrights and carpenters to meet the challenge of any project because they believe and what they're doing and are so very committed to getting each and every job done right. They include a clause in your contract that eliminates work slowdown and jurisdictional disputes because they believe that, as professionals, they can discuss and solve any problem while keeping your project on target on time. We'd like to take this opportunity to thank the men and women of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights for building the American dream and saving the American dream. Thank you.
The difference between what I do on my show and what all the right-wing types do on their shows is very simple. I'm not going to lie to you. That doesn't mean you're going to agree with me about everything or that you're going to like hearing everything I have to say, but I will guarantee you that when I say something on my show, I say it because I mean it and I believe it, and I'm not just saying it to get you riled up and to boost my ratings. No potty mouth, no trash talking, no BS, just the straight truth as I see it, because the lies may sound good for a while, but the truth is there forever. It's not always pleasant, it's not always nice, sometimes it's hard to see through all the crap, but it's there. And that's what you're going to get from me, and that's why you should listen to my show. The Cup of Joe Radio Show, Mondays and Fridays from noon to 2 Eastern Standard Time on the Head On Radio Network.
Hello, kids. Surprise, surprise. I'll bet you're wondering why I'm popping up out of the blue. Something new is headed your way. It's the show that dares ask the question, just why in the hell are the straight evangelical Christians recruiting gay kids for their perverted lifestyle? The answer to this and more coming in June.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool block skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
I never knew that everything was falling through, that everyone I knew was waiting on a cue to turn and run when all I needed was the truth. But that's how it's gotta be. It's coming down to nothing more than apathy. I'd rather run the other way than stay and see the smoke and who still standing when it clears.
Thirteen minutes before the hour, this is America's Liberal Voice. I'm Bob Kincaid, and we're going straight back to the phones in a second. A quick email for you, however. Paula from Midland, Texas, writes in and says, I'm so glad I found this radio program. I really have enjoyed listening. On top of voting to keep the war going, sending troops to their deaths along with scores of Iraqis, our Congress sanctioned militarized extortion to steal Iraqi oil for Bush Cheney and their oil company buddies. Who's going to stop this criminal nation of ours if Congress sanctions such atrocity? We stopped fascist Germany. Who's going to stop us? And should they try, what lengths will they have to go to in order to stop us? We used the atomic bomb on Japan. What will happen to us, the world? She says, thanks for your good work and your outrage. Well, there's only one reason for all of it. And that's to try to foster a dialogue and a conversation, to try to create a forum where people can share what they really think. Bless his heart, you know, Albert said, you know, you call into an NPR show and you got to go really fast. We're not into really fast here. Paula references an article by Anne Wright, not very long at all, over at Truthout, guest contribution there. It was published Saturday the 26th, just a couple of paragraphs. If you go and look for Anne Wright, you'll probably find it. On Thursday, May 24th, the U.S. Congress voted to continue the war in Iraq. The members called it supporting the troops. I call it stealing Iraq's oil, the second largest reserves in the world. The benchmark or goal the Bush administration has been working on furiously since the U.S. invaded in Iraq is privatization of Iraq's oil. Now they have Congress blackmailing the Iraqi parliament and the Iraqi people. No privatization of Iraqi oil, no reconstruction funds. This threat could not be clearer. If the Iraqi parliament refuses to pass the privatization legislation, Congress will withhold U.S. reconstruction funds that were promised to the Iraqis to rebuild what the United States has destroyed there. The privatization law, written by American oil company consultants hired by the Bush administration, would leave control with the Iraq National Oil Company for only 17 of the 80 known oil fields. The remainder, two-thirds of known oil fields and all yet undiscovered ones, would be up for grabs by the private oil companies of the world. But guess how many would go to United States firms given to them by the compliant Iraqi government?
Excuse me?
No other nation in the Middle East has privatized its oil. Go read this. It's not very long at all. Anne Wright. She was 29 years in the U.S. Army and the U.S. Army Reserves, retired as a colonel. 16 years in the U.S. Diplomatic Corps in Nicaragua, Grenada, Somalia, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Sierra Leone, Afghanistan, Micronesia, and Mongolia. She resigned from the Department of State in March 2003 because of this war on the people of that pathetic, pitiful nation, Iraq. Let's do go to the phones. Thank you again, Paula. Share your thoughts anytime. Let's go to the phones. David's calling from Maine. Hey, David, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Bob.
How are you?
I'm doing all right. And I just wanted to touch on a few things about the hemp thing and the energy sources.
Yeah.
I always say it's never there's never just one source. It's always people who are merchanting out the information and telling you, by the way, hemp can do this, hemp can do that. You know what? If you look hard enough, there are tons of resources on the planet that can do that. It's just that people don't have the distribution for the information, and also they don't have the. There's a lot of more complications with it involved. I mean, I think, you know, when.
But there's no getting around the fact that hemp is less energy intensive than corn by a long shot.
Oh, I don't argue that, but I'm saying it's. We're going to have to come across, you know, where we're going to have a cornucopia of sources. It's not just going to be.
No. Any kind of agricultural monoculture is bad, and that's what we're finding out with number two field corn. The so-called Roundup Ready corn, the stuff that you can poison your ground, and the stuff will still grow in poison. The only problem being, it's not fit to eat. You know that's you know. You can get a lot more out of any given hemp plant than you can out of any given stalk of number two field grade corn, which is literally taken over the United States. I mean, it's what you see growing in every field that looks like a cornfield, just about.
Right. Well, it's not that I don't doubt it. I've just heard that mantra before of hemp this and hemp that. I mean, I grew up in. Partly in Maine. I just heard it over and over and over again. I mean, to me, again, it's just the selling of a product or an energy resource. I mean, like I said, it's endless amounts of energy resources we can go with. So, I mean, I think when someone just centers in on one thing, and also I don't think it's going to be an energy resource. I don't think it's going to be something from the ground. I think it's going to be from something else. Something that's not here yet, obviously.
And in the meantime, we've got to deal with what we do have.
Right, and that's when you have to divvy up the what you have for energy resources.
Yeah, I'm reminded by our good buddy the other David, the one in Tennessee. There's a huge 7,000-acre former family farm plot down in Murray County, Tennessee. The president James K. Polk's family. They didn't farm cotton there. They farmed hemp. And fully half of the hemp that was made in the U.S. in the 1830s, 1840s, and 1850s half of the rope made in the U.S. was made with Polk family hemp.
The problem with that, though, is that nobody seems to talk about it. It has too much of a stigma. They killed themselves with the high times, the marijuana. I mean, we have generations and generations of all these stereotypes.
Yeah, but that's a chicken and the egg argument, isn't it, David?
Not really, because I would think... See, the problem, again, we're living in a different generation now. They're going to point to that, and they're just going to take a soundbite, and they're going to say, well, that's marijuana, and this is what's going to happen. And again, they played themselves, I believe, the marijuana culture played themselves by playing up the smoking angle because they were making a lot of money on the paraphernalia and propaganda. It was a big business. Still is, High Times is. And a lot of the marijuana conventions.
And normal and all of that stuff, yeah.
Right, they played it up, and now look where we're at. They're just going to point back to that.
Well, that's what this, I mean, when this interview I was listening to while I was on the road, that was right where the DEA guy went.
Exactly, and there's
well, nothing, you know, they're going to smoke it.
And there's nothing you can do with a 10-second soundbite, because that's all the time people have to listen to something today, or they want to.
Well, yeah, I don't know. I think it would be very beneficial to see us take advantage of it. You know, whether it's hemp or any other oil bearing seed crop, I think is better for us. You know, that we can use for biodiesel. You know, I don't think we can grow switchgrass here because we're not Brazil. But hemp is uniquely suited to this climate.
Well, this ties into what I was talking about, how people are disgusted with the Democrats. I'm probably the only one on here that isn't disgusted with the Democrats, and I'm going to tell you why. Because the Democrats that come into office, they've got the bat phone hooked up to the corporations. If any of us, were in that stream of Washington right now, over the years, we would be whittled to nothing to answering that damn phone. That's just how it works. And when they call and they say, listen, that contribution, I'm not seeing the benefits, my bottom line, the profit.
Yeah, you're not surprised at it.
I'm not surprised at it.
No, I'm not surprised. I'm disgusted.
Well, I'm not disgusted either, because the problem is we're so connected to a corporate state that eventually we go back to this again. We're always going to keep going, bowing back to the corporations. And here's the problem. If you look and you see some of the clips of people, Democrats, mind you, who talk about, well, I would not shop at Walmart, but, you know, it's so cheap. I see that stuff all the time from a lot of progressives. And I think to myself, you know, there's going to be...
It's the same... Look, yeah, David, it's the same mindset that that somebody who considers himself a liberal or a progressive called Cindy Sheehan an attention whore. Yeah,
right.
Those are the same people. You know what I mean? I mean, do you see what I'm saying?
Not really. Well, I'm not following you on that.
You know, the people. You know, stuff is cheap at Walmart. You know, but I'm a liberal. You know.
Yeah. Right. But what I'm saying is this: is that we keep on circling the wagons, so to speak. We keep circling the wagons, and really what it is it's going to be die-hard sacrifice. That's what it's going to have to come down to, either sooner or later. That's how it is, because free-reign capitalism, I say this every time, every month or so that I'm on here, it doesn't work. It's not going to work.
No, rampant unregulated capitalism only works in an Ayn Rand book.
Exactly, and they're see, conservatives, this is how I put it. Conservatives have crippling control, while liberals, I hate to say it, we have compassionate control. That's the only way I can say it. I raise my hands and say, well, you guys are controlling. You're damn right a lot of people are controlling things because they don't want to go to a crippling mind state where you're just frozen and you're eating pea soup. And you have foil on the windows, and you're worrying about tomorrow or whatever, and that's what they want to lead us to.
Well, it's halfway to where we are, isn't it?
I look at it and that goes to my point of, if we keep on going to Walmart, if people keep buying from Pizza Hut, if people keep going to McDonald's, people keep getting Nike shoes, or what have you, every single little corporate dollar we have, these corporations are going to go, wow, these people love us.
Yeah, and it all flows outside the United States. I'm glad you reminded me of something. After our conversation coming up here in a minute with Paul Waldman from Media Matters, something as simple as toothpaste, a horrifying thing. But I don't have time to get after it now, and we're up against the news. David, good to hear from you, brother. And, you know, we will continue to explore this in future programs. And I understand what you're saying. You're not disgusted. You're not even surprised.
Nope.
But that doesn't mean it's good, does it?
No, it doesn't. But, again, we have to look at ourselves in the mirror, Bob. Before I go, we have to look at ourselves in the mirror and realize we are all to blame with everything we do in this country. All of us.
Yeah, we do. Absolutely. Thanks a lot, David.
No problem, Bob.
Later. So much that we've got the conversation coming up. If you're on hold, we'll come to you right after the conversation, or if you want to come call back, we'll be done about half past the hour or thereabouts. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn. And, you know, we do have to get we've got to have that sort of intervention moment where we look in the mirror and realize that we are responsible. Because we are. We're paying the taxes. We're building the bombs. We're killing the Iraqis. And we can be disgusted with the elected representatives who did what they did this past Friday all we want to. But there's not a million of us around the Capitol in Washington, D.C. I ain't one of them. You're not one either. Won't change until we are. And Bob Kincaid.
Summertime blues, jump up and down in the blue suede shoes. Hey, yeah, you rock and roll, rock on. And where do we go from here? Which is a way.
This is the Quality News Network. It's been the deadliest month in Iraq. 10 American soldiers were killed in roadside bombings and a helicopter crash. 5 Britons were kidnapped. The death toll for May is now at least 112 soldiers. The soldier's mother, who represented the anti-war movement, is stepping down. Cindy Sheehan said she wanted to spend more time with her 3 children and said she was disappointed the Democrats, quote, caved in to George Bush. Her son, Casey Sheehan, was killed in Iraq in 2004. In Baghdad this morning, a terrorist car bomb exploded downtown, killing 23 and wounding 55. Another car bomb struck the western part of the city, killing 15 and wounding 36. President Bush is cracking down on the Sudanese government. He announced sanctions against the Sudan in response to the government's lack of action against genocide. 200,000 Sudanese have died since violence started in 2003. Responding to criticism over the new immigration plan, President Bush lashed out at opponents. During a speech at the nation's largest law enforcement center, the president said critics don't know what's right for America. In Tehran, 3 Iranian Americans have been formally charged with endangering national security and espionage by Iran. No trial date has been set, and investigations continue into the charges. Russia successfully test-launched a new intercontinental ballistic missile this morning. The new weapon system can travel 3,400 miles and carries multiple warheads. The test firing comes amid tension between Moscow and Washington over the U.S.'s planned weapon system in Europe. Representatives from more than 100 companies and 25 states are in Cuba trying to launch a program to sell agricultural products to Havana. Backed by 5 U.S. members of Congress, the industry executives are calling on the White House to ease sanctions against Cuba. In Jackson, Mississippi, jury selection begins tomorrow in the murder trial of a 71-year-old former Ku Klux Klan member accused of killing 2 young black men 43 years ago. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are looking for airline passengers who may have been exposed to a drug-resistant form of tuberculosis. The infected patient traveled on Air France, Flight 385, arriving in Paris May 13th. This is the Quality News Network.
Divorce is never a pleasant experience, but it doesn't have to be a tragedy. If you can rein in the emotions, step back from the anger and the victimhood, you can end your marriage with dignity instead of rancor. You got married with the best of intentions. Now you need to untie the marital knot with the same mutual respect. Choose collaboration instead of confrontation. Stop wasting money on lawyers. Don't drag this out for 5 years. A collaborative divorce is better for the children, family, and friends. Collaboration costs a fraction of a contended divorce and can be done within weeks rather than months or years. An award-winning documentary called Divorce Collaborative Style explains how you can end your marriage fairly and efficiently. For less than what a lawyer charges to answer one simple question, you can get all the answers from Divorce Collaborative Style. Go to collaborativedivorce.tv and order your DVD today. If it's over, end it right. CollaborativeDivorce.tv.
They're getting closer. Delta and Dawn, the two lost whales, are now 35 miles from the Pacific Ocean. The wounds on their skin also appear to be getting better. Biologists think that might be due to antibiotics injected into the whales on Saturday. International scientists have made a landmark breakthrough in research against the deadly avian flu. A vaccine produced with the blood of bird flu survivors is protecting lab mice from the virus. Researchers say a human vaccine could be available in the future. Brazil is launching a national program to provide subsidized birth control pills to its poorest citizens. Consumer confidence rebounded this month. The Consumer Confidence Index rose 108 to 108. That's up 2 points from last month. The good news comes despite shoppers' concern about high gas prices. GoDaddy.com will take over and manage over 850,000 addresses of a troubled rival. The leading registration company agreed to take on the customers of rival Registry Fly. And light sweet crude oil is trading at $63.15 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. The Dow closed up 14 points to at 13,521. The NASDAQ closed up 15 points. And the S&P 500 is up 2 points. There's more news at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Claudia Eisen.
Tonight's final hour of Head On begins now. 1-877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 1-877-443-2366. Here's Buck.
Welcome back. 6 minutes after the hour, 6 minutes after 8 o'clock here in the Eastern Time Zone. God only knows what time it is where you are around this sweet little blue-green marble hurtling through the universe. I'm Bob. And, you know, we've been talking at some length about what happened on Friday with the war resolution vote, the war supplemental vote, you know, we can't even budget for it properly because there's so much fraud involved. And you ask yourself, you know, why does this happen? How does this happen? Of course, yeah, one of the easy answers is the media help it happen. And there was a press conference today in Washington, D.C., regarding the release of a new study from our friends over at Media Matters for America, mediamatters.org. The name of the study is Left Behind, the Skewed Representation of Religion in the Major News Media. And it documents something that is probably noticeable if you take time to look at it, and that is, just like everything else conservative religion gets a bigger dose of the media pie than any other point of view. We're joined right now by Paul Waldman. Paul is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America. He's been on the program before. Thank you very much for taking your time to have a conversation with us, Paul. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. It's my pleasure.
Now, as I mentioned, this was released today. You've done some in-depth research there at Media Matters, and you found out that it's even spread so far as religion, the right wing domination of the media atmosphere, has it not?
Yeah, we wanted to look at who it is that gets to represent religious Americans and religious opinion. You know, people might remember that after the 2004 election, when President Bush won over John Kerry, there was a lot of talk about the influence of religious conservatives, religious voters, what people in the media like to refer to as values voters. Now,
yes.
I think values voters are voters who have values, but that's not actually true. When they say values voters, what they mean is conservative Christians. And, you know, all this came about because really of a sort of a misreading of a pretty vague exit poll question about what influenced people's votes, and a lot of people said moral values. Turns out that people mean very different things when they say that. But one of the consequences was that you saw a real increase in coverage of religion in the media, particularly as it intersects with politics. The problem was, as we thought it might be, that a lot of that coverage really centered around conservative religious people and conservative religious leaders. So we decided to see if this was really true, our impression, and to see if we could quantify it. So what we did was we looked at the 2 years following that election, from the 2004 election through the end of 2006, and managed to assemble a top 10 list of progressive religious leaders and conservative religious leaders, the people who got quoted the most, and then compare them to each other. And what it turns out is that the conservative religious leaders appear in the media. They get quoted, they get mentioned, they get interviewed. Depending on what piece of the media pie you're looking at, anywhere from 2.5 to 4 times as often as the progressive religious leaders. So for every time that you see a progressive religious leader, you may see conservative religious leaders 3 or 4 times. And that indicates that there's a real imbalance there, particularly when those conservative religious folk are not really the majority in the country. You know, one of the things that this creates is the impression that religious people are conservative, and that the Republican Party is the party of religious people, and therefore the Democratic Party must be the party of people who are not religious. And that's not really true. The fact of the matter is that, you know, America, as people might know, is probably the most religiously observant country in the industrialized world, with the possible exception of Ireland. But most Americans are religious and express a faith in God, and most Democrats do, and most Republicans do. And so when what you're seeing in the media, when they want to talk about how, you know, what religious voters are thinking or what religious people are doing, they turn to conservatives more often, far more often than they turn to progressives or even moderates. That's a real problem because it really misrepresents what's going on in America.
So let me ask you a question relating to methodology, Paul. You talk about conservative religious leaders. What did you use to determine what is a conservative versus a progressive or liberal religious personality?
Well, we wanted to keep things as sort of crisp and clear as we could, and as objective as we could. So we didn't look at people who were sort of in the middle. You know, there are some religious leaders who are somewhat complex, and you know, they may have conservative views on some issues and more liberal views on others, and so we stayed away from them. We looked at people who are either clergy or heads of religiously based organizations that really have a clear ideology, and there's no question about where they stand.
Your Falwells, your Dobsons, your Robertsons, D. James Kennedy, Richard Land from the Southern Baptist Convention, those kind of people?
Exactly. So you have those people on the right, and then you have people on the left like Jim Wallis or Tony Campolo. And those names are probably less familiar to people, and there's a reason for that.
Yep.
Actually, we excluded some of the a few of the most prominent people who are kind of personalities in their own right. We put them in their own section, but didn't use them to calculate our data. 5 people: Dobson, Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell on the right, and Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton on the left. People, you know, they're all ministers, but Dobson's not a minister. But they're such prominent personalities that they're kind of entities in and of themselves. What we were really interested in is when a reporter wants to get a religious opinion, who do they turn to sort of offer the religious perspective on the day's events? Are they just turning to someone like Richard Land, who you mentioned from the Southern Baptist Convention, who gets a lot of quotes in the press, or are they turning to him and also a progressive religious leader? And it turns out that they're not very often turning to those progressive religious leaders. And I think that part of the problem, this comes into play especially with the political reporters who are writing political stories, when they're thinking about you know, how an issue is going to play among religious voters, their first impulse, I think, often is to turn to someone like Richard Land, who's very conservative and has close ties to the Republican Party. And they figure, you know, they know who he is, they know he gives good quotes, and they probably got his phone number, and they can just get a quote from him, and that will give the religious perspective. But what we were trying to argue, and we had this press conference today in Washington with a number of these progressive religious leaders, is that there are a whole bunch of progressives out there who have a slightly different religious perspective, but it's equally valid and would really expand the debate and make it more interesting. But by and large, they're not getting those phone calls from reporters.
And it's obvious that they're not. And the question then becomes one of, you know, like you said with the politician, it's the easy flip of the Rolodex. Is this journalistic laziness then, or is it something that goes a little bit deeper, like what you were talking about initially, this notion that somehow liberals are irreligious versus conservatives are the pious ones? Has that invested itself so deeply into the media psyche that they don't even realize that they're doing it?
I think that's probably true. That it's not, you know, we're not saying that there's some sort of sinister intention out there. That reporters are saying, well, you know, I know that that there are a lot of progressive religious people, but I'm going to purposefully ignore them to try to create the impression that all religious people are conservative. You know, I don't think that's what they're doing. I think in some cases it may just be laziness, that they know who they can get a quote from quickly, and they've already got those names and they've gotten quotes from those people before. And I think a lot of it may just be that, as you said, this idea that religious equals conservative has just gotten sort of wormed its way into their mind to the point where they don't really even think about it much anymore. And you know, it's true that there's been a real effort on the part of religious conservatives to be more politically active and politically organized. And so you have some of those people who have assembled a really high profile. I mean, someone like James Dobson, who, as I said, is not a minister. He leads Focus on the Family, and he has, you know, built it up into this vast, enormous organization that has a couple thousand employees. And, you know, he has a radio show that's on hundreds of stations, and the Republican candidates feel like they have to go on his radio show.
And he's got 50 subsidiary individual state level family foundation organizations out there doing the low level grunt work in the individual states as well. But you mentioned Paul that he was not part of your calculations, and the fact that you still come back with numbers as high as four times 4-1 the conservative over progressive or liberal, and that is with Dobson and his ilk removed, that if you factor that back in, that gives me a pretty strong idea of how pervasive this so-called conservative religious mindset is.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and I think that, you know, one of the things that we're hoping is that reporters will start to think about this. You know, because as I said, I don't think they have a sinister intention, but maybe now they can say, well, you know, that's a good point, and there are a whole bunch of progressive religious leaders who have a lot to say about political issues and are active politically, and would be quite willing to comment on these things and, you know, go on the Sunday shows or on cable news shows and give quotes to newspaper reporters, if they were asked. And so maybe those reporters will start to expand their Rolodex a little bit, and then you'll begin to get kind of a fuller picture of where religious opinion is. Because, you know, I mentioned that exit poll that talked about moral values and people basing their votes on moral values. There was another poll that was taken after the election that asked people, you know, what the most important moral values are to them. And the things that came out on top were not abortion and same-sex marriage. Those came out near the bottom. They were the Iraq War. It was poverty. It was things like greed and materialism. Those were the things that people thought of when they thought about moral values. So those are, you know, examples of where a large portion of the public is thinking really in progressive terms about those issues when they think about how their faith affects how they think about politics. And so I think when you begin to talk to people who have that perspective, you really get kind of a fuller and more accurate picture of how these issues really are affecting the political world.
What is the... in terms, okay, so you're aiming this to a certain extent at journalists to sort of hold the mirror up and let them see that they're not intentionally, but not representing the full spectrum of what may be religious thought in this country. What about the religious groups themselves, Mr. Walden? Are these is there any hope or any purpose in this study that, you know, you did this jointly with Faith in Public Life as well? Is there a proactive component to this to urge or encourage progressive clergy to make themselves a more public face?
I think so. And, you know, if you talk to some of these progressive religious leaders, what they'll say is, hey, you know, I've been active in politics for 30 years. But, you know, we had this press conference today with a number of clergy members, and one of them, Bob Edgar, who is the head of the National Council of Churches and is a former congressman also, he was saying that, you know, one of the things that conservatives have done well is that they have thought about how they're going to interact with the media. And he said, you know, we need to go into our seminaries, we need to go into the churches and start training people to be more public about their, you know, about what they believe and their beliefs about politics, and to think about what makes a good, you know, how to give a good interview and how to really advocate for your beliefs in the media. And his argument was that progressives haven't done enough of that, and they haven't done as much as conservatives have. So I think there is that feeling out there among some people in the progressive religious community that they need to be more more proactive when it comes to, you know, kind of forcing themselves into the media's attention. But, you know, it's a two-way street. You can put out press releases and sometimes they'll be ignored. So I think that there is a growing awareness on the part of progressive religious people that they need to get organized. And I think you are starting to see that happen. You know, there are coalitions, there are organizations like Faith and Public Life, which has, I think, as part of its mission, getting those progressive religious people out there into the public eye. So these things are really starting up now, and I think you're beginning to see some fruits of that, some higher visibility, but they have a pretty long way to go before they'll get to the same point that the conservatives are at.
Well, it took the I just got done reading the book. I can't remember the author offhand, but the book, The Jesus Machine, and he catalogs very succinctly the fact that that building this media monolith that the religious right has built has been a process of nigh unto a generation. So this is certainly not something where you're suggesting that they need to be like the other side. It's a matter of exposing people to the message. Do I have it correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And you make a good point about how long conservatives have worked at it. You know, I wrote a whole book about this, actually. It's called Being Right Is Not Enough. And the subtitle was What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. And one of the points I made there is that one of the things that they did really well is they had patience. And I think this applies to the conservative movement in general and also to conservative religious people, is that they saw the gaining of political influence as a long-term project, something that they were willing to invest decades in, because they said, you know, it doesn't matter if it's not so important whether we win the next election. We want to have a real impact in a way that's going to take 30 years to build. And so they were patient, and they built it very methodically, and they've reaped the fruits of that building. And I think that progressives who are smart will look at their movement, whatever piece of it is, whether it's, you know, an electoral movement, electoral reform movement, or religious progressives having more influence, and say, okay, you know, let's see what effect we can have this year, but let's also think about what effect we can have in 10 years and in 20 years, and do the things now to set that foundation up that will allow us to build that movement.
Is there a danger, Paul, encouraging religious leaders to speak out more on the progressive side? I don't know quite how to ask this. We have complained loud and long about the religionization of the Bush administration, for instance, mm-hmm. With all this faith-based money, you know, taxpayer dollars going to support things that many of us believe the First Amendment should probably preclude. Is there a danger that we by our side entering this debate more vociferously, more forcefully, if you will, that we are endangering the republic by furthering theological influence on what many of us deem should be a secular government?
I think that it depends on how it's done, and again, you know, this is one of the things I heard today at this press conference. I think that memory serves, I think this was a point that David Saperstein, who's a rabbi with the Religious Action Center, was making, is that conservatives often have this kind of black and white worldview about theology in addition to politics that lends itself well to sensationalism and often gets them coverage. What you find among the progressive religious leaders is that they're much less likely to say that, you know, that God is speaking through them and that God demands this particular vote in this election or on this piece of legislation. That's generally not the way that they we're all values voters, and we all bring our fundamental beliefs into the public sphere. The question is, you know, what do you do once you've got them there? And are you saying that you're on God's side and everybody else is against God? Are you trying to make the government itself more religious and to have more of an involvement in religion and to bring church and state closer together? Those are not things that I see from the progressive religious people, even when they're talking about how their faith leads them to certain kinds of values and certain kinds of positions on issues. It's much less of a kind of a demand that everyone else adhere to what they interpret as God's will, so much as, you know, coming in with an argument that all people can accept. And I think that's really one of the fundamental requirements of democratic debate. You have to be able to make arguments that anyone can accept, even if they don't agree with you on some things or if they have a different religion than you. And, you know, I think that's what turns so many people off about people like the late Reverend Falwell, about Pat Robertson, is their insistence that their way is the only way, and that it's because of their reading of Scripture that we have to have certain kinds of policies or certain people must be elected. But, you know, you can never convince somebody who doesn't share your reading of Scripture or your particular religion if that's the argument that you're making. And I don't hear progressive religious leaders making those kinds of arguments. They're talking about how their faith brings them to certain sorts of impulses and certain kinds of values, but it's the arguments that they make can be accepted by people who don't share their faith. So it's a different kind of language that they speak.
And it's a difficult debate, though, isn't it, Paul? Because what you've just described, I've seen a million times on television, especially on the shows that foster and thrive on ginned up controversy. It's awfully difficult to have a conversation or a dialogue in this country and have one side say, well, you know, my faith leads me to believe that how we treat the poor is more important than how we treat a fetus, and the other side responds with, yes, but you're going to hell.
Yeah, once it's gotten to that point, then, you know, then you're not having a discussion anymore. And that's, you know, that's really a larger problem of the way a lot of our debate takes place. And, you know, I say this as somebody who sometimes goes on those programs, that, you know, you often feel after being on one of those cable shout fests, like it didn't really accomplish anything or convince anyone one way or the other. But I think that progressive people have reacted to that in the past often by sort of shying away and saying, well, you know, we're not even going to bother with that. But I think when you cede the field to the other side in that way, then they're the only ones who are convincing anyone. So
because theirs is the only voice that's out there.
Yeah, and if you are smart about it, you can have a compelling discussion even in the course of, you know, even if you're trading sound bites. Because, you know, there's, as my old English teacher used to say when I was in high school, there's a difference between the simple and the simplistic. And you can have a very simple message that can be communicated easily and is nonetheless very profound. You know, ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, is a very simple yet profound idea that was communicated in a soundbite. So it is possible to even in those kinds of forums that are not giving you the most the kind of time you might like to explain things, it's possible to get important ideas across.
Well, where does is this going to become an ongoing study similar to the conservative versus progressive presence on the Sunday news shows? You know, you did you at Media Matters, you did one, you followed up with it this year. Are you going to continue to look at this to see if these things trend in a different direction?
We haven't decided yet whether or not we're going to do a follow up. That I think that if there's enough interest in it, we may, because, you know, there's an election coming up and it'll be interesting to see. You know, obviously, it would be wonderful if we put this report out and all of a sudden the entire American media was transformed. That would be great.
Yeah. Well, I won't even say little by little. I think it's obvious that you at Media Matters are having a profound impact, and it's an impact that has been desperately needed. the very fact that the Bortzes and the Limbaughs and the Hannitys and the Savages are having kittens with crocheted tails on the air every time you catch them up in some of their garbage tells me that you're going in the right direction. I would like to hope that some of this can happen as well from a religious standpoint. Let me ask one last question, Paul, before we let you go, because I promised I wouldn't keep you more than 25 minutes or so. In this study, and by the way, can folks go read it?
Yes, it's at MediaMatters.org. You can see it on the front page, or you can go directly to MediaMatters.org/leftbehind.
Okay. In your survey of these stories, did any particular topic come up as far as religious coverage was concerned, or were you able to see some trending in the way the national debate over something like, say, the war was shaped? Did anything rise to the surface?
Not really. And you know, what you see is that across a whole range of issues, you find that those kind of cast of usual suspects of conservative leaders are quoted again and again, whether it's over something. An issue like the war in Iraq, or kind of the standard issues of abortion and gay marriage, or even just about articles about the election. And so what our hope is that particularly the political reporters who have so much influence and are in some ways kind of at the top of the heap in the news industry, as they're looking toward 2008 and other issues, that they kind of expand their Rolodexes and think about offering those different sorts of perspectives rather than just the conservative ones that have been so often offered in the past.
Well, I hope I laud your efforts. You guys do great work. My congratulations on another wonderful report. I read what I was sent, and it's enlightening. I think you're shedding more and more light on the way that media functions in this country, and in doing so, I think maybe you cause us to take a we look with a little bit more jaundiced eye because of what you've put out there, because it does seem like there's more to it than meets the eye, and I applaud you for all that you do.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
And I hope we'll talk again soon.
I look forward to it.
Take care.
All right, bye.
Bye now. Paul Waldman, Senior Fellow at Media Matters for America. Again, the name of the report, Left Behind, the Skewed Representation of Religion in the Major News Media. It's available at MediaMatters.org, MediaMatters.org/leftbehind. Go and read it. I think, again, they factored out the Dobsons and the Falwells and the Robertsons, and still, at a rate of about 4-1 on TV news, you get conservative religious leaders over anybody that could conceivably be considered liberal or progressive. We'll be back with your phone calls, your thoughts, and a couple more stories before we close out the evening. You're listening to America's Liberal Voice. You're listening to The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Let me know that I've done wrong.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. An army of labor activists will be in the streets of 9 states this summer as Working America goes door to door to mobilize American working families. Working America is a 1.6 million member community affiliate of the AFL-CIO. Its members are workers who are not in unions. Working America's focus right now is on health care, and it plans to have 2.5 million members by Labor Day 2008. Helmets to Hard Hats is an apprenticeship program started in New York City in 2003 that helps military veterans, active duty personnel, and reservists to find good union jobs after they leave the service. Helmets to Hard Hats, Ann Trinkle says it's an excellent way to reward and honor those who serve the country by helping transition them into solid middle class and higher jobs in the construction industry.
After the service that these young men and women have provided to our country, we feel as an industry it's only right that they should be rewarded with an opportunity to become the middle class or higher of the country.
Trinkle says the length of time spent in the Helmets to Hard Hats program varies according to the requirements of the particular trade involved. She says this program is a unique opportunity to help create the future, a good middle class future, for those who serve in the military.
Helmets to Hard Hats is the first time an industry as a whole has come together and with a national initiative that connects transitioning active duty and reserve component members with training and employment opportunities within the construction industry nationwide.
When bus drivers in Detroit were denied police protection for themselves and their passengers, they walked off their jobs just before the Memorial Day weekend. That solidarity got action. Henry Gaffney is president of Transit Workers 26 in Detroit.
We got drivers being assaulted, passengers being assaulted, people robbed, people shot at. My members just got fed up. The following day, the council did make a decision, and they did pass it so that we could get the Wayne County Sheriff's up on the bus.
United Food and Commercial Workers, Local 876 in Detroit, has a tentative contract agreement with Kroger covering 9,100 workers at 101 stores, but the union is facing the challenge of possible job losses at 66 Farmer Jack's grocery stores that are being sold by A&P. The union expects just 20 or so to remain operating as unionized stores owned by Kroger. ACORN, Association of Community Organizations for Reform Now, says there's a home foreclosure crisis nationwide following a decade of reckless subprime lending and mortgage marketing. ACORN activists this month protested the crisis by demanding that Denver's Office of Public Trustee institute a six-month moratorium on foreclosures, and in Cleveland, ACORN activists interrupted a sheriff's auction May 14th to protest people losing their homes. As many as 2.2 million homes are at risk for foreclosure. You've been listening to WIND, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Recently on the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network.
If you have tuned into this program by mistake right now, and you are a Republican, a right-wing Republican specifically, before this program is over, I do want to warn you, you're going to think that I'm the devil. You're going to think I've got horns and a red cape because I hate the Bush administration and everything they stand for. So be warned right away, okay? You're all warned right now that that's where we're coming from today.
Don't miss Guy James, weekdays, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, on the Head On Radio Network.
Hi, kids. You know, there have been a few questions about who is this guy starting a gay conversation radio show on the Head On Radio Network? And what color is the sky in his world? Not to worry, I totally get it.
Minutes or so left in the program. Going to go right back to the phones here in just a second. I want to, we got done with Labor Radio News, however, and I wanted to tack something onto that. because we got screwed again today. Did you know that? Yes, we did. We did. I know. Different day, same screwing. A case involving a lady by the name of Lily Ledbetter. Lily Ledbetter was a supervisor for a long, long time at Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company's plant in Gadsden, Alabama. She found out, after the better part of her career, she found out that for years and years, Goodyear had been paying her something on the order of $6,500 less per year than they paid the lowest paid male supervisor. Okay? With me so far? She'd spent 19 years with Goodyear, and she was making $45,000 a year, and it was $6,500 less than the lowest paid male supervisor. The company said, well, you know, this was because of poor performance evaluations. It had nothing to do with discriminating against her for her gender. So she retired in 1998, shortly after she claimed discrimination, and she sued. The trial court jury said, hey, we heard you, honey. Yeah, this was discrimination. They discriminated against you because you were a woman, and they awarded her back pay and benefits. It went up on appeal. She lost on appeal. It was appealed to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court delivered their opinion today, 5-4, with, of course, Samuel Alito making the difference. What did they rule? They ruled that she filed her claim too late and was barred from claiming claiming discrimination based on gender under the Civil Rights Act. Now, bear in mind, she worked for the company for 19 years, and for 19 years she was underpaid, and she had no way of discovering it. No way of finding it out. No way of learning it. But even though she had no way of knowing it, and therefore suing over it, the Supreme Court today, those conservative family values, Supreme Court justices, said that even though she had no way of knowing it, she still had to file within the time when she would have known it. In other words, the Supreme Court today, those conservatives, ruled that she had to be clairvoyant. I mean, Jesus! Women in the workplace face enough of a challenge. Now, they also, you know, congratulations, you've been hired at Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company. Here's your badge, here's your helmet, here's your work boots and your work suit and your uniform and your Ouija board. Yes, Agnes.
Well, girls, I guess we have to become Cassandra and then they can lock us in the dungeon for being insane.
No, because they're not going to believe you if you're Cassandra.
That's the whole point. Yeah, so can't be clairvoyant.
Okay, they said if you wait too long under the civil rights law, you're out of luck. Samuel Alito said, quote, the passage of time may seriously diminish the ability of the parties and the fact finder to reconstruct what actually happened. Now remember, this is Samuel Alito. This is the guy who had a hissy because they were going to let girls into his beloved Princeton. Remember that? I remember that. Ledbetter said she didn't sue earlier because employees are less willing to rock the boat when they're new on the job and have no reason to believe there could be such pay disparity. In other words, she had no knowledge. How could she sue? Well, Samuel Alito said, you know, basically that Jesus should have told her. Or, you know, I don't know, the magic eight ball should have told her. Or the Ouija board. Or you know, Madame Celestra, reader of palms over there on the corner, should have told her. This is a civil rights case. This is an employee rights case. And this is going to have broad implications. And every time I see one of these stinking cases that Alito has been so instrumental in deciding, I remember my senator, Robert Byrd, talking about how he had notes with donut stains on them and coffee circles from where Alito's fitness for the court had been discussed around the family dining room table, and he was going to vote for him because he was pretty sure that Samuel Alito would stand up for religious rights in America. Guess what? What the Supreme Court did today, Senator Byrd, is not very Christian. Senator Byrd, you see, your boy Sam Alito just told America, and it has the force of law, like unto law from handed down from on high, Senator. He told America that it is okay for corporations in this country to mistreat their fellow persons. After all, corporations are persons, aren't they? It's okay to mistreat persons based upon the accident of their birth. Because, you see, a back pay claim, this isn't necessarily about her being female. This is a back pay claim, and it would have been the same back pay claim had she contended that she was paid less and proven that she was paid less if she was African-American. Is the same as if she was female? Is it the same if she was, say, Mexican-American? These are civil rights claims. And this is sick. In America now, in conservative right-wing America, you have to, because you see, there was no doubt on the part of the trier of fact, i.e. the jury, that she had been discriminated against. And a judge who never saw a witness, who never heard a witness testify, who never observed a witness on the stand to judge credibility in that manner, nothing but the sterility of dry transcripts before them, a judge intervened and said, "No, jury, you're wrong, and I'm right." Now, think about Judge Alito next time you hear some right-wing fundamentalist cretin freak talk about activist judges. There's your activist judge, Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito.
Weren't they just talking about a judicial pay raise? Not too long ago. That's right, kids. Send those emails. Tell them they don't get it. If they can't do the job, they don't get the pay.
All right, and Luke is calling in. Hey, Luke, welcome to the program.
Evening, Bob.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, fine. Well, I tell you, the one problem I had with your guest, and I agree with his findings and all that, is this is turning into sort of like what they told us about during the Reagan years, where, oh, by the way, the media isn't supposed to bring up, all these factual problems. We have to bring it up over on the left. And it's like, I'm sorry, this is where I'm beating the media on the head going, why aren't you asking questions?
Right.
I mean, these religious guests they love having on, I still want to see them one time get to give Mr. Dobson a question. Well, Mr. Dobson, you go on some fella named O'Reilly's show, so you believe that phone sex is okay, right?
Yeah.
You know, I want to see him challenge some of these people, on some of the things going on with people on the right, but they'll let them sit there and pontificate for a half an hour on what they don't like about the left. You know, just somebody stand up with a spine and ask a question. Oh, I tell you. The one that got to me this weekend, though, was the best one, I think. I turn on Sunday morning, and our local channel here carries Matthew's CNBC show.
Yeah.
The first 15 minutes he spends going after Hillary over these new books coming out and all this, you know what I mean, and just sitting here and rumor-mongering and all this. Then, for the next 5 minutes, he sits there and jumps on people for about having JFK conspiracy theories.
Huh?
Well, he was on this new, one of these new books about JFK, you know, about his assassination.
Yeah, about the guy urging for new bullet analysis to be done.
Yeah, and he's sitting there going, well, anybody that believes any of this stuff is just, you know, tinfoil hat. And I'm sitting there going, and you just spent the last 15 minutes doing conspiracy theories on Hillary.
Sure.
I mean, because when you sit there and look at these new books, let's see, you've got Jeff Gerth, who we know from Whitewater fame.
Right.
The Gene Lyons and Joe Connison tore him apart. The lady, I believe, is named Van Atta or something like that, that did it with him. And if she's the one I'm thinking of, I've seen her on news programs before, and she hates the Clintons. But you ain't got to listen to her 5 minutes and you know that.
Sure.
Then apparently poor Carl Bernstein has fallen so low that I saw two quotes were out of his book that were attributed to the toe sucker.
Hanging out with Dick Morris, is he?
Well, I mean, and this is the same Dick Morris who, if I'm not mistaken, about 6-7 years ago said he would tell any lie necessary to bring down Bill and Hillary Clinton. You know,
yeah,
he
yeah,
did
and
that publicly,
right? Yeah, I mean, it's not like he was, you know, it wasn't like he, Carl had to go meet him in a garage somewhere.
I'd be afraid of him getting run over down there. Couple of quick things. If you watch the midnight replay, the first about 25-30 minutes of Mr. Olbermann's show tonight is interviewing Al Gore.
Ah.
And apparently there's going to be a second part tomorrow on his show. Just wanted to warn you, anybody wants to know.
Yeah, I'll have to stay up for that.
Okay. You were talking a minute ago about hemp a while back with David, I believe. You got to remember, though, if you ever look into that, that comes mainly from the cotton manufacturers.
Oh, them too. Yeah, I forgot about the cotton.
Because
yeah.
Most people don't know that industrial hemp, if you made a pair of jeans out of industrial hemp, they'll last like 5 times longer than cotton jeans.
Yeah.
Because hemp is incredibly durable compared to cotton. And that was one of the more reasons they banned hemp, i.e. marijuana. And you know, if you've ever listened to experts, they'll say, yeah, industrial hemp, you could probably smoke it, but you won't get anything out of it. Because it's not the same thing. When you process it, it takes out the chemicals that you get high off of.
Sure. Exactly.
So it'll be about as good smoking a rope.
Well, I had forgotten about the textile industry. But then again, we don't have a textile industry in this country anymore. Maybe that's part of why we're making some progress.
But you know what I mean?
We could rejuvenate the textile industry.
I agree. I think they should. I mean, like I say, if you've ever read stuff, I mean, you can go to, different magazines here and there. You know what I mean? But like I say, you know, different growing stuff, you know, where they'll talk about it openly, you know, about industrial hemp that you can't get people to mention because, like you say, the first thing they do, oh, marijuana? No.
You smoke it, Buster. I ain't.
Oh, I tell you what, though. But what was the other one? I had one other thing. I'm going to figure it out here in a second ago. Oh, this thing. I tell you what, we're going to have something that I think the next few months is I think with all this attention on Michael Moore's new movie, that the healthcare thing is going to come back up again.
Yeah, and because apparently it's being received rather well among right-wingers even.
What was it, the reviewer for Fox?
God bless you, Mr. Moore, yeah.
you gotta wonder if the minute after he saw that, Murdoch must have had a fit.
You're fired.
It's like, yeah, we're just going to shoot you now, just save time. You know how it is. It's sort of take no chances. Oh, one quick warning. If anybody goes to see Pirates of the Caribbean, which I enjoyed, don't drink anything before you go. It is a long movie.
With lots of explosions.
Well,
kidney-rattling explosions.
Well, it's one of those things. It's a very not complicated, but I mean, there's a lot of twists and turns, so you don't want to miss any of it.
Right. Okay, cool.
All right, then. I'm going to let you go. Right.
Take it easy, Luke. Good to talk to you, brother.
Bye.
Bye now. And Richard calling in from the West Coast. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
Hi, we haven't talked in a while, Bob.
It has been a while.
Yeah. I got a few things on my mind that I thought I'd share with you.
Okay.
One is for people in California, and especially if we got any listeners in San Francisco, I just have a little reminder. what's her name? Who's our person?
Pelosi?
Yeah. Yeah, Pelosi, you know, one thing that I really need to point out is that the residents of San Francisco voted to impeach George Bush. There was a proposition, and it passed by 59%. So when she's talking about impeachment being off the table, she's going right against her own constituency.
Well, exactly, and that's why that, you know, there's this movement afoot out there. I've been getting a lot of emails about Richard, you know, begging for a credible primary opponent.
Yes, I would go for that. I think Guy James had one caller who said, and he's in Florida, who said that he would put money toward a campaign like that. Wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah, well, it would, because there are skeletons in Nancy Pelosi's closet, Richard. You know, that she, her family, if I understand correctly, are significant owners in a vineyard and a highfalutin hotel called the Aubergine, I believe it is. And, you know, Nancy Pelosi has taken boatloads of money from organized labor. Both that vineyard and hotel are strictly non-union shops.
Oh, really? Yeah, are these American?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I lived in San Francisco for 11 years, and I worked for the city. And I am suspicious of politicians, you know, in San Francisco. There is a political establishment, and it's typically, you know, in the Democratic Party, because that's the only party in effect in the city.
Yeah.
And they tend to get a lot of money from people like Bechtel. Bechtel is a family-owned San Francisco company.
Well, sure, and look at the money that that Dianne Feinstein has raked in off the war. Her, you know, her husband is part and parcel of who? You know, tremendous war war money coming coming to her husband out of all of this.
Yeah, I remember that there was some connection. You know, I'm not too clear on it, but I recall that Pelosi virtually gave away the Presidio. The Presidio is a former military, an army base in San Francisco. It's actually a gorgeous park, you know, hilly, and it's been turned into real estate development. And George Lucas is big in that. I mean, he moved.
Mm-hmm.
He moved his whole operation into the former army hospital on the Presidio, you know, a lot of people were opposed to that, and it was sort of railroaded through. My own congressman, George Miller, it's one of the only two things I know of where he's ever voted for something that I was against, and that was it.
George generally does the right thing.
He does, but, you know, I envision that Nancy Pelosi is at the heart of a political machine that I'm very suspicious of, and it's been very bad for San Francisco over the years.
I think she's guilty, at least where the war is concerned, Richard, I think she's guilty of overthink.
Yeah, what do you mean?
She thinks she's engaging in some sort of a battle royal chess match where she's got to think eight moves ahead. She's only got one move, and that is stopping George Bush.
I would think so. And you know, one thing, I think I'll call up my, you know, my rep and say, look, here's what I want you to do. It's very simple. Whatever George wants, I want you to be against it.
It's not hard to do. That's what we gave them a majority to do.
Well, something is happening, and I think, you know, the there is the assumption that we can't pull the troops out of Iraq, for instance, because the Republicans won't go for it. Well, I think the task for us is to work on the Republicans in the Congress, and especially in the Senate, and say to these guys, look, your party is on the line. This guy is destroying the Republican Party and you with it. And if you don't impeach him, he's going to take you down with him.
Well, you know, it would be fine by me if they did, but Richard, this was done with a lot, what happened Friday was done with a lot of Democratic compliance.
Oh, I know.
Complicity, if you will.
Yeah.
And that's what makes me try to emphasize the importance of the primary process. Primaries, you know, elections every 2 years for an incumbent should not be treated as a coronation. It's not like we're telling them we don't love them anymore. It's, you know, it's just that, you know, you're not doing the job. Time to let somebody else try. You know, because the repetition, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result is the textbook definition of insanity, isn't it?
That's right. And I think, you know, as I've watched Feinstein's political career, it's been, you know, amazingly shrewd because it's always been, well, who are you going to vote for?
And then
there's somebody worse.
Yeah. And the lesser of two evils is still evil.
Yeah.
Richard, I've got to break it off because we're so close to the top of the program. Call again soon, will you, please?
Okay, man.
All right. Take care.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, bye. Thanks, Agnes, who did a lovely job. Thanks to John Fox, our chief engineer. To Peter Godbold, our IT consultant. Thanks to the hardest working man in liberal talk, Ben Birch, over at WhiteRoseSociety.org. If you value what happens on the horn, you value the hard work of Ben Birch. Thanks to the United Brotherhood of Carpenters, who made this network get off the ground. They're building the American dream every day as we help to save the American dream. Bedtime for you, Liza. And always, 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 RMR, Gina, it's all for you. You're listening to The Horn, the head-on radio network.
This is the Quality News Network. President Bush has chosen former U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick to head the World Bank. The official announcement comes tomorrow and is expected to be approved by the other member nations. Zoellick is taking over from Paul Wolfowitz, who is stepping aside on June 30th. The White House is cracking down on the Sudanese government with new sanctions. The reason? Sudan's lack of action against genocide. 200,000 Sudanese have been killed since violence started there in 2003. The Sudanese government shot down the action, saying the crackdown was, quote, unfair and untimely, end quote. In Iraq, 10 U.S. soldiers have died in a roadside bombing and a helicopter crash. 5 British soldiers have been kidnapped. Terrorists employed car bombs in 2 separate areas of Baghdad this morning. They killed 23 people downtown and 15 on Baghdad's west side. In Tehran, 3 Iranian Americans have been formally charged with spying by Iran. No trial date's been set, and investigations continue into the charges, which include allegations that the United States is using internal critics in an attempt to destabilize the country. The EU's foreign policy chief announced that he'll meet this week with Iran's chief nuclear envoy to discuss Tehran's uranium enrichment. He hopes to restart the stalled international negotiations on Iran's nuclear program. In Madrid, a court has sentenced 3 Pakistani-born men for collaborating with a terrorist group. The trio will serve 5 years in prison. The 3 men and 8 others were acquitted of more serious charges that included belonging to a terrorist group and conspiracy to commit terrorist acts. Russia has successfully test-launched an ICBM. It can carry 10